Hodge sat behind the enormous desk in a suit, his gray-streaked hair silvered by the dawn light. For a moment, she thought he was alone in the room, that Jace had been playing a joke on her. Then she saw a figure move out of the dimness, and she realized that what she had thought was a patch of darker shadow was a man. A tall man in a heavy robe that fell from neck to foot, covering him completely. The hood of the robe was raised, hiding his face. The robe itself was the color of parchment, and the intricate runic designs along the hem and sleeves looked as if they'd been inked there in drawing blood. The hair rose along Clary's arms and on the back of her neck, prickling almost painfully. "This," said Hodge, "is Brother Jeremiah of the Silent City." The man came toward them, his heavy cloak swirling as he moved, and Clary realized what it was about him that was strange. He made no sound at all as he walked, not the slightest footstep. Even his cloak, which should have rustled, was silent. She would almost have wondered if he were a ghost. But no, she thought as he halted in front of them. There was a strange, sweet smell about him, like incense and blood, the smell of something living. "And this, Jeremiah," Hodge said, rising from his desk, "is the girl I wrote you about, Clarissa Frey." The hooded face turned slowly toward her. Clary felt cold to her fingertips. "Hello," she said. There was no reply. "I decided you were right, Jace," said Hodge. "I was right," said Jace. "I usually am." Hodge ignored this. "I sent a letter to the Clave about all this last night, but Clary's memories are her own. Only she can decide how she wants to deal with the contents of her own head. If she wants the help of the Silent Brothers, she should have that choice." Clary said nothing. Dorothea had said there was a block in her mind hiding something. Of course she wanted to know what it was, but the shadowy figure of the Silent Brother was so, well, silent. Silence itself seemed to flow from him like a dark tide, black and thick as ink. It chilled her bones. Brother Jeremiah's face was still turned toward her, nothing but darkness visible under his hood. "This is Jocelyn's daughter." Clary gave a little gasp, stepping back. The words had echoed inside her head as if she thought them herself, but she hadn't.
"Yes," said Hodge, and added quickly, "but her father was a mundane."
"That does not matter," said Jeremiah. "The blood of the Clave is dominant." "Why did you call my mother Jocelyn?" said Clary, searching in vain for some sign of a face beneath the hood. "Did you know her?"
"The brothers keep records on all members of the Clave," explained Hodge. "Exhaustive records."
"Not that exhaustive," said Jace, "if they didn't even know she was still alive."
"It is likely that she had the assistance of a warlock in her disappearance. Most shadow hunters cannot so easily escape the Clave."
There was no emotion in Jeremiah's voice. He sounded neither approving nor disapproving of Jocelyn's actions. "There's something I don't understand," Clary said. "Why would Valentine think my mom had the mortal cup? If she went through so much trouble to disappear, like you said, then why would she bring it with her?"
"To keep him from getting his hands on it," said Hodge. "She, above all people, would have known what would happen if Valentine had the cup, and I imagine she didn't trust the Clave to hold on to it. Not after Valentine got it away from them in the first place."
"I guess." Clary couldn't keep the doubt from her voice. The whole thing seemed so unlikely. She tried to picture her mother fleeing under cover of darkness with the big gold cup stashed in the pocket of her overalls, and failed.
"Jocelyn turned against her husband when she found out what he intended to do with the cup," said Hodge. "It's not unreasonable to assume she would do everything in her power to keep the cup from falling into his hands. The Clave themselves would have looked first to her if they thought she was still alive."
"It seems to me," Clary said with an edge to her voice, "that no one the Clave thinks is dead is ever actually dead. Maybe they should invest in dental records."
"My father's dead," said Jace, the same edge in his voice. "I don't need dental records to tell me that."
Clary turned on him in some exasperation. "Look, I didn't mean—"
"That is enough," interrupted Brother Jeremiah.
There is truth to be learned here, if you are patient enough to listen to it."
With a quick gesture, he raised his hands and drew the hood back from his face. Forgetting Jace, Clary fought the urge to cry out. The archivist's head was bald, smooth and white as an egg, darkly indented where his eyes had once been. They were gone now. His lips were crisscrossed with a pattern of dark lines that resembled surgical stitches. She understood now what Isabel had meant by mutilation.
"The brothers of the Silent City do not lie," said Jeremiah. "If you want the truth from me, you shall have it, but I shall ask of you the same in return."
Clary lifted her chin.
"I'm not a liar either." "The mind cannot lie."
Jeremiah moved toward her.
"It is your memories I want."
The smell of blood and ink was stifling. Clary felt a wave of panic. "Wait."
"Clary."
It was Hodge, his tone gentle.
"It's entirely possible that there are memories you have buried or repressed. Memories formed when you were too young to have a conscious recollection of them that Brother Jeremiah can reach. It could help us a great deal."
She said nothing, biting the inside of her lip. She hated the idea of someone reaching inside her head, touching memories so private and hidden that even she couldn't reach them.
"She doesn't have to do anything she doesn't want to do," Jay said suddenly. "Does she?"
Clary interrupted Hodge before he could reply. "It's all right. I'll do it." Brother Jeremiah nodded curtly and moved toward her with the soundlessness that sent chills up her spine.
"Will it hurt?" she whispered.
He didn't reply, but his narrow white hands came up to touch her face. The skin of his fingers was thin as parchment paper, inked all over with runes. She could feel the power in them jumping like static electricity to sting her skin. She closed her eyes, but not before she saw the anxious expression that crossed Hodge's face. Colors swirled up against the darkness behind her eyelids. She felt a pressure, a drawing pull in her head and hands and feet. She clenched her hands, straining against the weight, the blackness. She felt as if she were pressed up against something hard and unyielding, being slowly crushed. She heard herself gasp and went suddenly cold all over, cold as winter. In a flash, she saw an icy street, gray buildings looming overhead, an explosion of whiteness stinging her face in freezing particles. "That's enough." Jace's voice cut through the winter chill and the falling snow vanished, a shower of white sparks. Clary's eyes sprang open. Slowly, the library came back into focus. The book-lined walls, the anxious faces of Hodge and Jace. Brother Jeremiah stood unmoving, a carved idol of ivory and red ink. Clary became aware of the sharp pains in her hands and glanced down to see red lines scored across her skin where her nails had dug in.
"Jace," Hodge said reprovingly.
"Look at her hands." Jace gestured toward Clary, who curled her fingers in to cover her injured palms. Hodge put a broad hand on her shoulder.
"Are you all right?"
Slowly she moved her head in a nod. The crushing weight had gone, but she could feel the sweat that drenched her hair, pasted her shirt to her back like sticky tape.
"There is a block in your mind," said Brother Jeremiah. "Your memories cannot be reached."
"A block?" asked Jace. "You mean she's repressed her memories?"
"No. I mean they have been blocked from her conscious mind by a spell. I cannot break it here. She will have to come to the Bone City and stand before the Brotherhood."
"A spell?" said Clary incredulously. "Who would have put a spell on me?"
Nobody answered her.
Jace looked at his tutor. He was surprisingly pale, Clary thought, considering that this had been his idea.
"Hodge, she shouldn't have to go if she doesn't. It's all right."
Clary took a deep breath. Her palms ached where her nails had cut them, and she wanted badly to lie down somewhere dark and rest. "I'll go. I want to know the truth. I want to know what's in my head."
Jace nodded once. "Fine, then I'll go with you."
Leaving the Institute was like climbing into a wet, hot canvas bag. Humid air pressed down on the city, turning the air to grimy soup. "I don't see why we have to leave separately from Brother Jeremiah," Clary grumbled.
They were standing on the corner outside the Institute. The streets were deserted except for a garbage truck trundling slowly down the block. What, is he embarrassed to be seen with Shadowhunters or something?
The Brotherhood are Shadowhunters, Jace pointed out. Somehow, he managed to look cool despite the heat. It made Clary want to smack him.
I suppose he went to get his car? She inquired sarcastically.
Jace grinned. Something like that. She shook her head.
You know, I'd feel a lot better about this if Hodge had come with us.
What? I'm not protection enough for you?
It's not protection I need right now. It's someone who can help me think. Suddenly reminded, she clapped a hand over her mouth. Oh, Simon!
No, I'm Jace, said Jace patiently. Simon is the weaselly little one with the bad haircut and dismal fashion sense.
Oh, shut up, she replied, but it was more automatic than heartfelt. I meant to call before I went to sleep, see if he got home okay.
Shaking his head, Jace regarded the heavens as if they were about to open up and reveal the secrets of the universe. With everything that's going on, you're worried about Weasel Face?
Don't call him that. He doesn't look like a weasel.
You may be right, said Jace. I've met an attractive weasel or two in my time. He looks more like a rat.
He does not.
He's probably at home lying in a puddle of his own drool. Just wait till Isabel gets bored with him and you have to pick up the pieces.
Is Isabel likely to get bored with him? Clary asked.
Jace thought about this.
Yes, he said.
Clary wondered if perhaps Isabel was smarter than Jace gave her credit for. Maybe she would realize what an amazing guy Simon was, how funny, how smart, how cool. Maybe they'd start dating. The idea filled her with a nameless horror.
Lost in thought, it took her several moments to realize that Jace had been saying something to her. When she blinked at him, she saw a wry grin spread across his face.
What? She asked ungraciously.
I wish you'd stop desperately trying to get my attention like this, he said. It's become embarrassing.
Sarcasm is the last refuge of the imaginatively bankrupt, she told him.
I can't help it. I use my rapier wit to hide my inner pain.
Your pain will be outer soon if you don't get out of traffic. Are you trying to get run over by a cab?
Don't be ridiculous, he said. We can never get a cab that easily in this neighborhood.
As if on cue, a narrow black car with tinted windows rumbled up to the curb and paused in front of Jace, engine purring. It was long and sleek and low to the ground like a limousine, the windows curved outward. Jace looked at her sideways. There was amusement in his glance, but also a certain urgency. She glanced at the car again, letting her gaze relax, letting the strength of what was real pierce the veil of glamour. Now the car looked like Cinderella's carriage, except instead of being pink and gold and blue like an Easter egg, it was black as velvet, its windows darkly tinted. The wheels were black, the leather trimmings all black. On the black metal driver's bench sat Brother Jeremiah, holding a set of reins in his gloved hands. His face was hidden beneath the cowl of his parchment-colored robe. On the other end of the reins were two horses, black as smoke, snarling and pawing at the sky.
Get in, said Jace.
When she continued to stand there gaping, he took her arm and half pushed her in through the open door of the carriage, swinging himself up after her. The carriage began to move before he had closed the door behind them. He fell back in his seat, plush and glossily upholstered, and looked over at her.
A personal escort to the Bone City is nothing to turn your nose up at.
I wasn't turning my nose up. I was just surprised. I wasn't expecting... I thought it was a car.
Just relax, said Jace. Enjoy that new carriage smell.
Clary rolled her eyes and turned to look out the windows. She would have thought that a horse and carriage wouldn't have stood a chance in Manhattan traffic, but they were moving downtown easily, their soundless progression unnoticed by the snarl of taxis, buses, and SUVs that choked the avenue. In front of them, a yellow cab switched lanes, cutting off their forward progress. Clary tensed, worried about the horses. Then the carriage lurched upward as the horses sprang lightly to the top of the cab. She choked off a gasp. The carriage, rather than dragging along the ground, sailed up behind the horses, rolling lightly and soundlessly up over the cab's roof and down the other side.
Clary glanced backward as the carriage hit the pavement again with a jolt. The cab driver was smoking and staring ahead, utterly oblivious.
"I always thought cab drivers didn't pay attention to traffic, but this is ridiculous," she said weakly. "Just because you can see through glamour now."
Jace let the end of the sentence hang delicately in the air between them.
"I can only see through it when I concentrate," she said. "It hurts my head a little."
"I bet that's because of the block in your mind. The brothers will take care of that."
"Then what?"
"Then you'll see the world as it is. Infinite," said Jace with a dry smile. "Don't quote Blake at me." The smile turned less dry.
"I didn't think you'd recognize it. You don't strike me as someone who reads a lot of poetry."
"Everyone knows that quote because of the Doors."
Jace looked at her blankly.
"The Doors? They were a band?"
"If you say so," he said.
"I suppose you don't have much time for enjoying music," Clary said, thinking of Simon, for whom music was his entire life.
"In your line of work."
He shrugged.
"Maybe the occasional wailing chorus of the damned."
Clary looked at him quickly to see if he was joking, but he was expressionless.
"But you were playing the piano yesterday," she began, "at the Institute, so you must..."
The carriage lurched upward again. Clary grabbed at the edge of her seat and stared. They were rolling along the top of a downtown M1 bus. From this vantage point, she could see the upper floors of the old apartment buildings that lined the avenue, elaborately carved with gargoyles and ornamental cornices.
"I was just messing around," said Jace without looking at her.
"My father insisted I learn to play an instrument."
"He sounds strict, your father."
Jace's tone was sharp.
"Not at all. He indulged me. He taught me everything. Weapons training, demonology, arcane lore, ancient languages. He gave me anything I wanted. Horses, weapons, books, even a hunting falcon."
"But weapons and books aren't exactly what most kids want for Christmas," Clary thought as the carriage thunked back down to the pavement.
"Why didn't you mention to Hodge that you knew the men that Luke was talking to? That they were the ones who killed your dad?"
Jace looked down at his hands. They were slim and careful hands, the hands of an artist, not a warrior. The ring she had noticed earlier flashed on his finger. She would have thought there would have been something feminine about a boy wearing a ring, but there wasn't. The ring itself was solid and heavy-looking, made of a dark burned-looking silver with a pattern of stars around the band. The letter W was carved into it.
"Because if I did," he said, "he'd know I wanted to kill Valentine myself, and he'd never let me try."
"You mean you want to kill him for revenge?"
"For justice," said Jace. "I never knew who killed my father. Now I do. This is my chance to make it right."
Clary didn't see how killing one person could make right the death of another, but she sensed there was no point saying that.
"But you knew who killed him," she said. "It was those men. You said..."
Jace wasn't looking at her, so Clary let her voice trail off. They were rolling through Astor Place now, narrowly dodging a purple New York University tram as it cut through traffic. Passing pedestrians looked crushed by the heavy air, like insects pinned under glass. Some groups of homeless kids were crowded around the base of a big brass statue, folded cardboard signs asking for money propped up in front of them. Clary saw a girl about her own age with a smoothly shaved bald head, leaning against a brown-skinned boy with dreadlocks, his face adorned with a dozen piercings. He turned his head as the carriage rolled by as if he could see it, and she caught the gleam of his eyes. One of them was clouded, as though it had no pupil.
"I was 10," Jace said.
She turned to look at him. He was without expression. It always seemed like some color drained out of him when he talked about his father.
"We lived in a manor house, out in the country. My father always said it was safer away from people. I heard them coming up the drive, and I went to tell him. He told me to hide, so I hid, under the stairs. I saw those men come in. They had others with them, not men. Forsaken. They overpowered my father and cut his throat. The blood ran across the floor. It soaked my shoes. I didn't move."
It took a moment for Clary to realize he was done speaking and another to find her voice.
"I'm so sorry, Jace."
His eyes gleamed in the darkness. I don't understand why mundanes always apologize for things that aren't their fault. I'm not apologizing. It's a way of empathizing, of saying that I'm sorry you're unhappy.
I'm not unhappy, he said. Only people with no purpose are unhappy. I've got a purpose.
Do you mean killing demons or getting revenge for your father's death?
Both.
Would your father really want you to kill those men, just for revenge?
A shadow hunter who kills another of his brothers is worse than a demon and should be put down like one, Jace said, sounding as if he were reciting the words from a textbook.
But are all demons evil? She said. I mean, if all vampires aren't evil and all werewolves aren't evil, maybe...
Jace turned on her, looking exasperated. It's not the same thing at all. Vampires, werewolves, even warlocks, they're part human. Part of this world, born in it. They belong here. But demons come from other worlds. They're interdimensional parasites. They come to a world and use it up. They can't build, just destroy. They can't make, only use. They drain a place to ashes, and when it's dead, they move on to the next one. It's life they want. Not just your life or mine, but all the life of this world. Its rivers and cities, its oceans, its everything. And the only thing that stands between them and the destruction of all this? He pointed outside the window of the carriage, waving his hand as if he meant to indicate everything in the city, from the skyscrapers uptown to the clog of traffic on Houston Street, is the Nephilim.
Oh, Clary said.
There didn't seem to be much else to say.
How many other worlds are there?
No one knows. Hundreds, millions, maybe.
And they're all dead worlds? Used up?
Clary felt her stomach drop, though it might have been only the jolt as they rolled up and over a purple mini.
That seems so sad.
I didn't say that. The dark orangey light of city haze spilled in through the window, outlining his sharp profile. There are probably other living worlds like ours, but only demons can travel between them. Because they're mostly non-corporeal, partly, but nobody knows exactly why. Plenty of warlocks have tried it, and it's never worked. Nothing from Earth can pass through the wardings between the worlds. If we could, he added, we might be able to block them from coming here, but nobody's ever been able to figure out how to do that. In fact, more and more of them are coming through. There used to be only small demon invasions into this world, easily contained. But even in my lifetime, more and more of them have spilled in through the wardings. The Clave is always having to dispatch shadow hunters, and a lot of times they don't come back.
But if you had the mortal cup, you could make more, right?
More demon hunters? Clary asked tentatively. Sure, Jay said. But we haven't had the cup for years now, and a lot of us die young, so our numbers slowly dwindle.
Aren't you,
Clary searched for the right word.
Reproducing?
Jace burst out laughing just as the carriage made a sudden sharp left turn. He braced himself, but Clary was thrown against him. He caught her, hands holding her lightly but firmly away from him. She felt the cool impress of his ring like a sliver of ice against her sweaty skin. Sure, he said. We love reproducing. It's one of our favorite things. Clary pulled away from him, her face burning in the darkness, and turned to look out the window. They were rolling toward a heavy wrought iron gate trellised with dark vines. We're here, announced Jace as the smooth roll of wheels over pavement turned to the jounce of cobblestones. Clary glimpsed words across the arch as they rolled under it. New York City Marble Cemetery. But they stopped burying people in Manhattan a century ago because they ran out of room, didn't they? She said. They were moving down a narrow alley with high stone walls on either side. The Bone City has been here longer than that. The carriage came to a shuddering halt. Clary jumped as Jace stretched his arm out, but he was only reaching past her to open the door on her side. His arm was lightly muscled and downed with golden hairs fine as pollen. You don't get a choice, do you? She asked. About being a shadow hunter. You can't just opt out. No, he said. The door swung open, letting in a blast of muggy air. The carriage had drawn to a stop on a wide square of green grass surrounded by mossy marble walls. But if I had a choice, this is still what I'd choose. Why? She asked. He raised an eyebrow,
which made Clary instantly jealous. She'd always wanted to be able to do that. "Because," he said, "it's what I'm good at." He jumped down from the carriage. Clary slid to the edge of her seat, dangling her legs. It was a long drop to the cobblestones. She jumped. The impact stung her feet, but she didn't fall. She swung around in triumph to find Jace watching her.
"I would have helped you down," he said.
She blinked.
"It's okay. You didn't have to."
He glanced behind him. Brother Jeremiah was descending from his perch behind the horses in a silent fall of robes. He cast no shadow on the sun-baked grass.
"Come," he said.
He glided away from the carriage and the comforting lights of Second Avenue, moving toward the dark center of the garden. It was clear that he expected them to follow. The grass was dry and crackling underfoot, the marble walls to either side smooth and pearly. There were names carved into the stone of the walls, names and dates. It took Clary a moment to realize that they were grave markers. A chill scraped up her spine. Where were the bodies? In the walls, buried upright as if they'd been walled in alive? She had forgotten to look where she was going. When she collided with something unmistakably alive, she yelped out loud. It was Jace.
"Don't screech like that, you'll wake the dead."
She frowned at him. "Why are we stopping?" He pointed at Brother Jeremiah, who had come to a halt in front of a statue just slightly taller than he was, its base overgrown with moss. The statue was of an angel. The marble of the statue was so smooth it was almost translucent. The face of the angel was fierce and beautiful and sad. In long white hands, the angel held a cup, its rim studded with marble jewels. Something about the statue tickled Clary's memory with an uneasy familiarity. There was a date inscribed on the base, 1234, and words inscribed around it. Nephilim, Facilis descensus averni. "Is that meant to be the mortal cup?" she asked. Jace nodded.
"And that's the motto of the Nephilim, the shadow hunters there on the base."
"What does it mean?"
Jace's grin was a white flash in the darkness. "It means shadow hunters, looking better in black than the widows of our enemies since 1234.
Jace,
it means, said Jeremiah, the descent into hell is easy.
Nice and cheery, said Clary, but a shiver passed over her skin despite the heat.
It's the brother's little joke having that here, said Jace. You'll see.
She looked at Brother Jeremiah. He had drawn a stele, faintly glowing, from some inner pocket of his robe, and with the tip, he traced the pattern of a rune on the statue's base. The mouth of the stone angel suddenly gaped wide in a silent scream, and a yawning black hole opened in the grassy turf at Jeremiah's feet. It looked like an open grave. Slowly, Clary approached the edge of it and peered inside. A set of granite steps led down into the hole, their edges worn soft by years of use. Torches were set along the steps at intervals, flaring hot green and icy blue. The bottom of the stairs was lost in darkness. Jace took the stairs with an ease of someone who finds a situation familiar, if not exactly comfortable. Halfway to the first torch, he paused and looked up at her.
"Come on," he said impatiently.
Clary had barely set her foot on the first step when she felt her arm caught in a cold grip. She looked up in astonishment. Brother Jeremiah was holding her wrist, his icy white fingers digging into the skin. She could see the bony gleam of his scarred face beneath the edge of his cowl.
"Do not fear," said his voice inside her head. "It would take more than a single human cry to wake these dead."
When he released her arm, she skidded down the stairs after Jace, her heart pounding against her ribs. He was waiting for her at the foot of the steps. He'd taken one of the green burning torches out of its bracket and was holding it at eye level. It lent a pale green cast to his skin.
"You all right?"
She nodded, not trusting herself to speak. The stairs ended in a shallow landing. Ahead of them stretched a tunnel, long and black, ridged with the curling roots of trees. A faint bluish light was visible at the tunnel's end.
"It's so dark," she said lamely. "You want me to hold your hand?"
Clary put both her hands behind her back like a small child. "Don't talk down to me." Well, I could hardly talk up to you. You're too short.
Jace glanced past her, the torch showering sparks as he moved.
No need to stand on ceremony, Brother Jeremiah, he drawled. Lead on. We'll be right behind you.
Clary jumped. She still wasn't used to the archivist's silent comings and goings. He moved noiselessly from where he had been standing behind her and headed into the tunnel. After a moment, she followed, knocking Jace's outstretched hand aside as she went. Clary's first sight of the Silent City was of row upon row of tall marble arches that rose overhead, disappearing into the distance like the orderly rows of trees in an orchard. The marble itself was a pure, ashy ivory, hard and polished-looking, inset in places with narrow strips of onyx, jasper, and jade. As they moved away from the tunnel and toward the forest of arches, Clary saw that the floor was inscribed with the same runes that sometimes decorated Jace's skin with lines and whorls and swirling patterns. As the three of them passed through the first arch, something large and white loomed up on her left side, like an iceberg off the bow of the Titanic. It was a block of white stone, smooth and square, with a sort of door inset into the front. It reminded her of a child-sized playhouse, almost, but not quite big enough for her to stand up inside.
It's a mausoleum, said Jace, directing a flash of torchlight at it.
Clary could see that a rune was carved into the door, which was sealed shut with bolts of iron.
A tomb. We bury our dead here.
All your dead? She said, half wanting to ask him if his father was buried here, but he had already moved ahead out of earshot. She hurried after him, not wanting to be alone with Brother Jeremiah in this spooky place. I thought you said this was a library.
There are many levels to the Silent City, interjected Jeremiah. And not all the dead are buried here. There is another ossuary in Idris, of course, much larger. But on this level are the mausoleums and the place of burning.
The place of burning?
Those who die in battle are burned. Their ashes used to make the marble arches that you see here. The blood and bone of demon slayers is itself a powerful protection against evil. Even in death, the clave serves the cause.
How exhausting, Clary thought, to fight all your life and then be expected to continue that fight even when your life was over. At the edges of her vision, she could see the square white vaults rising on either side of her in orderly rows of tombs, each door locked from the outside. She understood now why this was called the Silent City. Its only inhabitants were the mute brothers and the dead they so zealously guarded. They had reached another staircase leading down into more twilight. Jace thrust the torch ahead of him, streaking the walls with shadows. We're going to the second level, where the archives and the council rooms are, he said as if to reassure her.
Where are the living quarters? Clary asked, partly to be polite, partly out of real curiosity.
Where do the brothers sleep?
Sleep.
The silent word hung in the darkness between them. Jace laughed, and the flame of the torch he held flickered.
You had to ask.
At the foot of the stairs was another tunnel, which widened out at the end into a square pavilion, each corner of which was marked by a spire of carved bone. Torches burned in long onyx holders along the sides of the square, and the air smelled of ashes and smoke. In the center of the pavilion was a long table of black basalt veined in white. Behind the table, against the dark wall, hung an enormous silver sword pointed down, its hilt carved in the shape of outspread wings. Seated at the table was a row of silent brothers, each wrapped and cowled in the same parchment-colored robes as Jeremiah. Jeremiah wasted no time.
We have arrived. Clarissa, stand before the council.
Clary glanced at Jace, but he was blinking, clearly confused. Brother Jeremiah must have spoken only inside her head. She looked at the table, at the long row of silent figures muffled in their heavy robes. Alternating squares made up the pavilion floor, golden bronze and a darker red. Just in front of the table was a larger square, made of black marble and embossed with a parabolic design of silver stars. Clary stepped into the center of the black square as if she were stepping in front of a firing squad. She raised her head.
All right, she said. Now what?
The brothers made a sound then, a sound that raised the hairs up all along Clary's neck and the backs of her arms.
It was a sound like a sigh or a groan. In unison, they raised their hands and pushed their cowls back, burying their scarred faces in the pits of their empty eyes. Though she had seen Brother Jeremiah's uncovered face already, Clary's stomach knotted. It was like looking at a row of skeletons, like one of those medieval woodcuts where the dead walked and talked and danced on the piled bodies of the living. Their stitched mouths seemed to grin at her. "The council greets you, Clarissa Frey," she heard, and it was not just one silent voice inside her head, but a dozen, some low and rough, some smooth and monotone, but all were demanding, insistent, pushing at the fragile barriers around her mind. "Stop," she said, and to her astonishment, her voice came out firm and strong. The din inside her mind ceased as suddenly as a record that had stopped spinning. "You can go inside my head," she said, "but only when I'm ready."
"If you do not want our help, there is no need for this. You are the one who asked for our assistance, after all."
"You want to know what's in my mind, just like I do," she said. "That doesn't mean you can't be careful about it." The brother, who sat in the center seat, templed his thin white fingers beneath his chin. "It is an interesting puzzle, admittedly," he said, and the voice inside her mind was dry and neutral.
"But there is no need for the use of force if you do not resist."
She gritted her teeth. She wanted to resist them, wanted to pry those intrusive voices out of her head, to stand by and allow such a violation of her most intimate, personal self. But there was every chance that had already happened, she reminded herself. This was nothing more than the excavation of a past crime, the theft of her memory. If it worked, what had been taken from her would be restored. She closed her eyes. "Go ahead," she said. The first contact came as a whisper inside her head, delicate as the brush of a falling leaf. "State your name for the council." "Clarissa Frey." The first voice was joined by others.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Clary. My mother is Jocelyn Frey. I live at 807 Berkeley Place in Brooklyn. I'm 15 years old. My father's name was..." Her mind seemed to snap in on itself like a rubber band, and she reeled soundlessly into a whirlwind of images cast against the insides of her closed lids. Her mother was hurrying her down a night-black street between piles of heaped and dirty snow. Then a lowering sky, gray and leaden, rows of black trees stripped bare, an empty square cut into the earth, a plain coffin lowered into it, ashes to ashes. Jocelyn wrapped in her patchwork quilt, tears spilling down her cheeks, quickly closing a box and shoving it under a cushion as Clary came into the room. She saw the initials on the box again. J.C. The images came faster now, like the pages of one of those books where the drawings seem to move when you flip them. Clary stood on top of a flight of stairs, looking down a narrow corridor, and there was Luke again, his green duffel bag at his feet. Jocelyn stood in front of him, shaking her head. "Why now, Lucien? I thought that you were dead." Clary blinked. Luke looked different, almost a stranger, bearded, his hair long and tangled, and branches came down to block her view. She was in the park again, and green fairies, tiny as toothpicks, buzzed among the red flowers. She reached for one in delight, and her mother swung her up into her arms with a cry of terror. Then it was winter on the black street again, and they were hurrying, huddled under an umbrella, Jocelyn half pushing and half dragging Clary between the looming banks of snow. A granite doorway loomed up out of the falling whiteness. There were words carved above the door. "The Magnificent." Then she was standing inside an entryway that smelled of iron and melting snow. Her fingers were numb with cold. A hand under her chin directed her to look up, and she saw a row of words scrawled along the wall. Two words leaped out at her, burning into her eyes. "Magnus Bane." A sudden pain lanced through her right arm. She shrieked as the images fell away and she spun upward, breaking the surface of consciousness like a diver breaking up through a wave. There was something cold pressed against her cheek. She pried her eyes open and saw silver stars. She blinked twice before she realized that she was lying on the marble floor, her knees curled up to her chest. When she moved, hot pain shot up her arm. She sat up gingerly. The skin over her left elbow was split and bleeding. She must have landed on it when she fell. There was blood on her shirt. She looked around, disoriented, and saw Jace looking at her, unmoving but very tense around the mouth. Magnus Bane. The words meant something, but what? Before she could ask the question aloud, Brother Jeremiah interrupted her.
"The block inside your mind is stronger than we had anticipated," he said. "It can be safely undone only by the one who put it there. For us to remove it would be to kill you."
She scrambled to her feet, cradling her injured arm. "But I don't know who put it there. If I knew that, I wouldn't have come here."
"The answer to that is woven into the thread of your thoughts," said Brother Jeremiah. "In your waking dream, you saw it written."
"Magnus Bane? But that's not even a name."
"It is enough."
Brother Jeremiah got to his feet. As if this were a signal, the rest of the brothers rose alongside him. They inclined their heads toward Jace, a gesture of silent acknowledgement, before they filed away among the pillars and were gone. Only Brother Jeremiah remained. He watched impassively as Jace hurried over to Clary.
"Is your arm all right? Let me see," he demanded, seizing her wrist.
"Ouch! It's fine, don't do that, you're making it worse," Clary said, trying to pull away.
"You bled on the speaking stars," he said. Clary looked and saw that he was right. There was a smear of her blood on the white and silver marble. "I bet there's a law somewhere about that."
He turned her arm over, more gently than she would have thought he was capable of. He caught his lower lip between his teeth and whistled. She glanced down and saw that a glove of blood covered her lower arm from the elbow to the wrist. The arm was throbbing, stiff and painful.
"Is this when you start tearing strips off your t-shirt to bind up my wound?" she joked. She hated the sight of blood, especially her own.
"If you wanted me to rip my clothes off, you should have just asked."
He dug into his pocket and brought out his stele.
"It would have been a lot less painful."
Remembering the stinging sensation when the stele had touched her wrist, she braced herself. But all she felt as the glowing instrument glided lightly over her injury was a faint warmth.
"There," he said, straightening up.
Clary flexed her arm in wonder. Though the blood was still there, the wound was gone, as were the pain and stiffness.
"And next time you're planning to injure yourself to get my attention, just remember that a little sweet talk works wonders."
Clary felt her mouth twitch into a smile.
"I'll keep that in mind," she said, and as he turned away, she added, "And thanks."
He slid the stele into his back pocket without turning to look at her, but she thought she saw a certain gratification in the set of his shoulders.
"Brother Jeremiah," he said, rubbing his hands together, "you've been very quiet all this time. Surely you have some thoughts you'd like to share."
"I am charged with leading you from the Silent City, and that is all," said the archivist.
Clary wondered if she were imagining it, or if there was actually a faintly affronted tone to his voice.
"We could always show ourselves out," Jace suggested hopefully. "I'm sure I remember the way."
"The marvels of the Silent City are not for the eyes of the uninitiated," said Jeremiah, and he turned his back on them with a soundless swish of robes. "This way."
When they emerged into the open, Clary took deep breaths of the thick morning air, relishing the city stench of smog, dirt, and humanity. Jace looked around thoughtfully.
"It's gonna rain," he said.
He was right, Clary thought, looking up at the iron gray sky. "Are we taking a carriage back to the Institute?" Jace looked from Brother Jeremiah, still as a statue, to the carriage looming like a black shadow in the archway that led to the street. Then he broke into a grin.
"No way," he said. "I hate those things. Let's hail a cab."
11. Magnus Bane. Jace leaned forward and banged his hand against the partition separating them from the cab driver.
"Turn left! Left! I said to take Broadway, you brain-dead moron!"
The taxi driver responded by jerking the wheel so hard to the left that Clary was thrown against Jace. She let out a yelp of resentment.
"Why are we taking Broadway anyway?"
"I'm starving," Jace said, "and there's nothing at home except leftover Chinese."
He took his phone out of his pocket and started dialing.
"Alec, wake up,"
he shouted. Clary could hear an irritated buzzing on the other end. Meet us at Taki's. Breakfast. Yeah, you heard me. Breakfast. What? It's only a few blocks away. Get going. He clicked off and shoved the phone into one of his many pockets as they pulled up to a curb. Handing the driver a wad of bills, Jace elbowed Clary out of the car. When he landed on the pavement behind her, he stretched like a cat and spread his arms wide.
Welcome to the greatest restaurant in New York.
It didn't look like much. A low brick building that sagged in the middle like a collapsed souffle. A battered neon sign proclaiming the restaurant's name hung sideways and was sputtering. Two men in long coats and tipped forward felt hats slouched in front of the narrow doorway. There were no windows.
It looks like a prison, said Clary. He pointed at her.
But in prison, could you order a spaghetti fra diavolo that makes you want to kiss your fingers?
I don't think so.
I don't want spaghetti. I want to know what a Magnus Bane is.
It's not a what, it's a who, said Jace. It's a name.
Do you know who he is?
He's a warlock, said Jace in his most reasonable voice. Only a warlock could have put a block in your mind like that. Or maybe one of the Silent Brothers, but clearly it wasn't them.
Is he a warlock you've heard of? Demanded Clary, who was rapidly tiring of Jace's reasonable voice.
The name does sound familiar.
Hey! It was Alec, looking like he'd rolled out of bed and pulled jeans on over his pajamas. His hair, unbrushed, stuck out wildly around his head. He loped toward them, eyes on Jace, ignoring Clary as usual.
Izzy's on her way, he said. She's bringing the mundane.
Simon? Where did he come from? Jace asked.
He showed up first thing this morning. Couldn't stay away from Izzy, I guess. Pathetic.
Alec sounded amused. Clary wanted to kick him.
Anyway, are we going in or what? I'm starving.
Me too, said Jace. I could really go for some fried mouse tails.
Some what? Asked Clary, sure that she'd heard wrong.
Jace grinned at her.
Relax, he said. It's just a diner.
They were stopped at the front door by one of the slouching men. As he straightened, Clary caught a glimpse of his face under the hat. His skin was dark red, his squared-off hands ending in blue-black nails. Clary felt herself stiffen, but Jace and Alec seemed unconcerned. They said something to the man, who nodded and stepped back, allowing them to pass.
Jace! Clary hissed as the door shut behind them. Who was that?
You mean Clancy?
Jace asked, glancing around the brightly lit restaurant. It was pleasant inside, despite the lack of windows. Cozy wooden booths nestled up against each other, each one lined with brightly colored cushions. Endearingly mismatched crockery lined the counter, behind which stood a blonde girl in a waitress's pink and white apron, nimbly counting out change to a stocky man in a flannel shirt. She saw Jace, waved, and gestured that they should sit wherever they wanted.
Clancy keeps out undesirables, said Jace, herding her to one of the booths.
He's a demon, she hissed.
Several customers turned to look at her. A boy with spiky blue dreads was sitting next to a beautiful Indian girl with long black hair and gauze-like golden wings sprouting from her back. The boy frowned darkly. Clary was glad the restaurant was almost empty.
No, he isn't, said Jace, sliding into a booth.
Clary moved to sit beside him, but Alec was already there. She settled gingerly onto the booth seat opposite them, her arms still stiff despite Jace's ministrations. She felt hollow inside, as if the Silent Brothers had reached into her and scooped out her insides, leaving her light and dizzy.
He's an Ifrit, Jace explained.
They're warlocks with no magic. Half-demons who can't cast spells for whatever reason.
Poor bastards, said Alec, picking up his menu.
Clary picked hers up too and stared.
Locusts and honey were featured as a special, as were plates of raw meat, whole raw fish, and something called a toasted bat sandwich. A page of the beverage section was devoted to the different types of blood they had on tap. To Clary's relief, they were different kinds of animal blood, rather than type A, type O, or type B negative.
Who eats whole raw fish? She inquired aloud.
Kelpies, said Alec. Selkies. Maybe the occasional Nixie. Don't order any of the fairy food, said Jace, looking at her over the top of his menu. It tends to make humans a little crazy. One minute you're munching a fairy plum, next minute you're running naked down Madison Avenue with antlers on your head. Not, he added hastily, that this has ever happened to me. Alec laughed. Do you remember, he began and launched into a story that contained so many mysterious names and proper nouns that Clary didn't even bother trying to follow it. She was looking at Alec instead, watching him as he talked to Jace. There was a kinetic, almost feverish energy to him that hadn't been there before. Something about Jace sharpened him, brought him into focus. If she were going to draw them together, she thought, she would make Jace a little blurry, while Alec stood out, all sharp, clear planes and angles. Jace was looking down as Alec spoke, smiling a little and tapping his water glass with a fingernail. She sensed he was thinking of other things. She felt a sudden flash of sympathy for Alec. Jace couldn't be an easy person to care about. I was laughing at you because declarations of love amuse me, especially when unrequited. Jace looked up as the waitress passed. Are we ever going to get any coffee? He said aloud, interrupting Alec mid-sentence. Alec subsided, his energy fading. Clary spoke up hastily. What's all the raw meat for? She asked, indicating the third page of her menu. Werewolves, said Jace. Though I don't mind a bloody steak myself every once in a while. He reached across the table and flipped Clary's menu over. Human food is on the back. She perused the perfectly ordinary menu selections with a feeling of stupefaction. It was all too much. They have smoothies here? There's this apricot plum smoothie with wildflower honey that's simply divine, said Isabel, who'd appeared with Simon at her side. Shove over, she said to Clary, who scooted so close to the wall that she could feel the cold bricks pressing into her arm. Simon, sliding in next to Isabel, offered her a half-embarrassed smile that she didn't return. You should have one. Clary wasn't sure if Isabel was talking to her or to Simon, so she said nothing. Isabel's hair tickled her face, smelling of some kind of vanilla perfume. Clary fought the urge to sneeze. She hated vanilla perfume. She never understood why some girls felt the need to smell like dessert. So, how did it go at the Bone City? Isabel asked, flipping her menu open. Did you find out what's in Clary's head? We got a name, said Jace. Magnus, shut up, Alec hissed, thwacking Jace with his closed menu. Jace looked injured. Jesus, he rubbed his arm. What's your problem? This place is full of downworlders, you know that. I think you should try to keep the details of our investigation secret. Investigation? Isabel laughed. Now we're detectives? Maybe we should all have code names. Good idea, said Jace. I shall be Baron Hotshaft von Hugenstein. Alec spit his water back into his glass. At that moment, the waitress arrived to take their order. Up close, she was still a pretty blonde girl, but her eyes were unnerving, entirely blue with no white or pupil at all. She smiled with sharp little teeth. Know what you're having? Jace grinned. The usual, he said, and got a smile from the waitress in return. Me too, Alec chimed in, though he didn't get the smile. Isabel fastidiously ordered a fruit smoothie. Simon asked for coffee, and Clary, after a moment's hesitation, chose a large coffee and coconut pancakes. The waitress winked a blue eye at her and flounced off. Is she an Ifrit too? Clary asked, watching her go. Kaylee? No, Partfay, I think, said Jace. She's got Nixie eyes, said Isabel thoughtfully. You really don't know what she is? Asked Simon. Jace shook his head. I respect her privacy. He nudged Alec. Hey, let me out for a second. Scowling, Alec moved aside. Clary watched Jace as he strode over to Kaylee, who was leaning against the bar talking to the cook through the pass-through to the kitchen. All Clary could see of the cook was a bent head and a white chef's hat. Tall, furry ears poked through holes cut into either side of the hat. Kaylee turned to smile at Jace, who put an arm around her. She snuggled in. Clary wondered if this was what Jace meant by respecting her privacy. Isabel rolled her eyes. He really shouldn't tease the wait staff like that. Alec looked at her.
You don't think he means it? That he likes her, I mean.
Isabel shrugged. She's a downworlder, she said, as if that explained everything.
I don't get it, said Clary.
Isabel glanced at her without interest.
Get what?
This whole downworlder thing. You don't hunt them because they aren't exactly demons, but they're not exactly people either. Vampires kill, they drink blood.
Only rogue vampires drink human blood from living people, interjected Alec. And those were allowed to kill.
And werewolves are what, just overgrown puppies?
They kill demons, said Isabel, so if they don't bother us, we don't bother them.
Like letting spiders live because they eat mosquitoes, Clary thought.
So they're good enough to let live, good enough to make your food for you, good enough to flirt with, but not really good enough. I mean, not as good as people.
Isabel and Alec looked at her as if she were speaking Urdu.
Different from people, said Alec finally.
Better than mundanes, said Simon.
No, Isabel said decidedly. You could turn a mundane into a shadow hunter. I mean, we came from mundanes, but
you can never turn a downworlder into one of the clave. They can't withstand the runes.
So they're weak, asked Clary.
I wouldn't say that, said Jace, sliding back into his seat next to Alec. His hair was mussed, and there was a lipstick mark on his cheek. At least not with a peri, a djinn, an ifrit, and God knows what else listening in.
He grinned as Kaylee appeared and distributed their food. Clary regarded her pancakes consideringly. They looked fantastic. Golden brown, drenched with honey. She took a bite as Kaylee wobbled off on her high heels. They were delicious.
I told you it was the greatest restaurant in Manhattan, said Jace, eating fries with his fingers.
She glanced at Simon, who was stirring his coffee, head down.
Mmph, said Alec, whose mouth was full.
Right, said Jace. He looked at Clary.
It's not one way, he said. We may not always like downworlders, but they don't always like us either. A few hundred years of the Accords can't wipe out 1,000 years of hostility.
I'm sure she doesn't know what the Accords are, Jace, said Isabel around her spoon.
I do, actually, said Clary.
I don't, said Simon.
Yes, but nobody cares what you know.
Jace examined a fry before biting into it.
I enjoy the company of certain downworlders at certain times and places, but we don't really get invited to the same parties.
Wait, Isabel suddenly sat up straight.
What did you say the name was?
She demanded, turning to Jace.
The name in Clary's head?
I didn't, said Jace. At least I didn't finish it. It's Magnus Bane. He grinned at Alec mockingly.
Rhymes with over-careful pain in the ass?
Alec muttered a retort into his coffee. It rhymed with something that sounded a lot more like ducking glass mole. Clary smiled inwardly.
It can't be, but I'm almost totally sure.
Isabel dug into her purse and pulled out a folded piece of blue paper. She wiggled it between her fingers.
Look at this.
Alec held out his hand for the paper, glanced at it with a shrug, and handed it to Jace.
It's a party invitation for somewhere in Brooklyn, he said. I hate Brooklyn.
Don't be such a snob, said Jace.
Then, just as Isabel had, he sat up straight and stared.
Where did you get this, Izzy?
She fluttered her hand airily.
From that Kelpie in Pandemonium. He said it would be awesome. He had a whole stack of them.
What is it? Clary demanded impatiently. Are you going to show the rest of us or not?
Jace turned it around so they could all read it. It was printed on thin paper, nearly parchment, in a thin, elegant, spidery hand. It announced a gathering at the humble home of Magnus the Magnificent Warlock and promised attendees a rapturous evening of delights beyond your wildest imaginings.
Magnus, said Simon. Magnus? Like Magnus Bane?
I doubt there are that many warlocks named Magnus in the tri-state area, said Jace.
Alec blinked at it.
Does that mean we have to go to the party? He inquired of no one in particular.
We don't have to do anything, said Jace, who was reading the fine print on the invitation. But according to this, Magnus Bane is the High Warlock of Brooklyn. He looked at Clary. I, for one, am a little curious as to what the High Warlock of Brooklyn's name is doing inside your head. The party didn't start until midnight, so with a whole day to kill, Jace and Alec disappeared to the weapons room, and Isabel and Simon announced their intention of going for a walk in Central Park so that she could show him the fairy circles. Simon asked Clary if she wanted to come along. Stifling a murderous rage, she refused on the grounds of exhaustion. It wasn't exactly a lie. She was exhausted, her body still weakened from the after effects of the poison and the too early rising. She lay on her bed in the Institute, shoes kicked off, willing herself to sleep, but sleep wouldn't come. The caffeine in her veins fizzed like carbonated water, and her mind was full of darting images. She kept seeing her mother's face looking down at her, her expression panicked. Kept seeing the speaking stars, hearing the voices of the Silent Brothers in her head. Why would there be a block in her mind? Why would a powerful warlock have put it there, and to what purpose? She wondered what memories she might have lost, what experiences she'd had that she couldn't now recall. Or maybe everything she thought she did remember was a lie. She sat up, no longer able to bear where her thoughts were taking her. Barefoot, she padded out into the corridor and toward the library. Maybe Hodge could help her. But the library was empty. Afternoon light slanted in through the parted curtains, laying bars of gold across the floor. On the desk lay the book Hodge had read out of earlier, its worn leather cover gleaming. Beside it, Hugo slept on his perch, beak tucked under wing. My mother knew that book, Clary thought. She touched it, read out of it. The ache to hold something that was a part of her mother's life felt like a gnawing at the pit of her stomach. She crossed the room hastily and laid her hands on the book. It felt warm, the leather heated by sunlight. She raised the cover. Something folded slid out from between the pages and fluttered to the floor at her feet. She bent to retrieve it, smoothing it open reflexively. It was the photograph of a group of young people, none much older than Clary herself. She knew it had been taken at least 20 years ago, not because of the clothes they were wearing, which, like most Shadowhunter gear, were nondescript and black, but because she recognized her mother instantly. Jocelyn, no more than 17 or 18, her hair halfway down her back and her face a little rounder, the chin and mouth less defined. She looks like me, Clary thought dazedly. Jocelyn's arm was around a boy Clary didn't recognize. It gave her a jolt. She'd never thought about her mother being involved with anyone other than her father, since Jocelyn had never dated or seemed interested in romance. She wasn't like most single mothers who trolled PTA meetings for likely-looking dads or Simon's mom who was always checking her profile on J-Date. The boy was good-looking, with hair so fair it was nearly white, and black eyes. That's Valentine, said a voice at her elbow. When he was 17. She leapt back, almost dropping the photo. Hugo gave a startled and unhappy caw before settling back down on his perch, feathers ruffled. It was Hodge, looking at her with curious eyes. I'm so sorry, she said, setting the photograph down on the desk and backing away hastily. I didn't mean to pry into your things. It's all right. He touched the photograph with a scarred and weathered hand, a strange contrast to the neat spotlessness of his tweed cuffs. It's a piece of your past, after all. Clary drifted back toward the desk as if the photo exerted a magnetic pull. The white-haired boy in the photo was smiling at Jocelyn, his eyes crinkled in that way that boys' eyes crinkled when they really liked you. Nobody, Clary thought, had ever looked at her that way. Valentine, with his cold, fine-featured face, looked absolutely unlike her own father, with his open smile and the bright hair she'd inherited. Valentine looks sort of nice. Nice he wasn't, said Hodge with a twisted smile. But he was charming and clever and very persuasive. Do you recognize anyone else? She looked again. Standing behind Valentine, a little to the left, was a thin boy with a shock of light brown hair. He had the big shoulders and gawky wrists of someone who hadn't grown into his height yet.
Is that you?
Hodge nodded.
And?
She had to look twice before she identified someone else she knew, so young as to be nearly unrecognizable. In the end, his glasses gave him away, and the eyes behind them, light blue as seawater.
Luke, she said. Lucian, and here.
Leaning over the photo, Hodge indicated an elegant-looking teenage couple, both dark-haired, the girl half a head taller than the boy. Her features were narrow and predatory, almost cruel.
The Lightwoods, he said. And there,
he indicated a very handsome boy with curling dark hair, high color in his square-jawed face,
is Michael Wayland.
He doesn't look anything like Jace.
Jace resembles his mother.
Is this, like, a class photo? Clary asked.
Not quite. This is a picture of the circle taken in the year it was formed. That's why Valentine, the leader, is in the front and Luke is on his right side. He was Valentine's second in command.
Clary turned her gaze away.
I still don't understand why my mother would join something like that.
You must understand.
You keep saying that, Clary said crossly. I don't see why I must understand anything. You tell me the truth and I'll understand it or I won't.
The corner of Hodge's mouth twitched.
As you say.
He paused to reach out a hand and stroke Hugo, who was strutting along the edge of the desk importantly.
This ends Disc 5. City of Bones, Disc 6.
The potion Hodge gave her smelled pleasantly of juniper and leaves. Clary kept opening the vial and smelling it on her way back down the corridor. It was unfortunately still open when she entered her bedroom and found Jace sprawled out on the bed looking at her sketchbook. With a little shriek of astonishment, she dropped the vial. It bounced across the floor, spilling pale green liquid onto the hardwood.
Oh dear, said Jace, sitting up, the sketchbook abandoned. I hope that wasn't anything important.
It was a sleeping potion, she said angrily, towing the vial with the tip of a sneaker. And now it's gone.
If only Simon were here, he could probably bore you to sleep.
Clary was in no mood to defend Simon. Instead, she sat down on the bed, picking up the sketchbook. I don't usually let people look at this.
Why not?
Jace looked tousled as if he'd been asleep himself.
You're a pretty good artist, sometimes even excellent.
Well, because it's like a diary, except I don't think in words, I think in pictures, so it's all drawings, but it's still private. She wondered if she sounded as crazy as she suspected.
Jace looked wounded. A diary with no drawings of me in it? Where are the torrid fantasies, the romance novel covers, the...
Do all girls you meet fall in love with you? Clary asked quietly.
The question seemed to deflate him, like a pin popping a balloon.
It's not love, he said after a pause. At least,
you could try not to be charming all the time, Clary said. It might be a relief for everyone. He looked down at his hands. They were like Hodge's hands already, snowflaked with tiny white scars, though the skin was young and unlined.
If you're really tired, I could put you to sleep, he said. Tell you a bedtime story.
She looked at him.
Are you serious?
I'm always serious. She wondered if being tired had made them both a little crazy. But Jace didn't look tired. He looked almost sad. She set the sketchbook down on the night table and lay down, curling sideways on the pillow.
Okay.
Close your eyes. She closed them. She could see the after image of lamplight reflected against her inner lids like tiny starbursts.
Once there was a boy, said Jace.
Clary interrupted immediately.
A shadow hunter boy?
Of course. For a moment, a bleak amusement colored his voice. Then it was gone. When the boy was 6 years old, his father gave him a falcon to train. Falcons are raptors, killing birds, his father told him. The shadow hunters of the sky. The falcon didn't like the boy, and the boy didn't like it either.
Its sharp beak made him nervous, and its bright eyes always seemed to be watching him. It would slash at him with beak and talons when he came near. For weeks, his wrists and hands were always bleeding. He didn't know it, but his father had selected a falcon that had lived in the wild for over a year, and thus was nearly impossible to tame. But the boy tried, because his father had told him to make the falcon obedient, and he wanted to please his father. He stayed with the falcon constantly, keeping it awake by talking to it and even playing music to it, because a tired bird was meant to be easier to tame. He learned the equipment, the jesses, the hood, the braille, the leash that bound the bird to his wrist. He was meant to keep the falcon blind, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. Instead, he tried to sit where the bird could see him as he touched and stroked its wings, willing it to trust him. He fed it from his hand, and at first it would not eat. Later, it ate so savagely that its beak cut the skin of his palm. But the boy was glad because it was progress, and because he wanted the bird to know him, even if the bird had to consume his blood to make it happen. He began to see that the falcon was beautiful, that its slim wings were built for the speed of flight, and it was strong and swift, fierce and gentle. When it dived to the ground, it moved like light. When it learned to circle and come to his wrist, he nearly shouted with delight. Sometimes the bird would hop to his shoulder and put its beak in his hair. He knew his falcon loved him, and when he was certain it was not just tamed, but perfectly tamed, he went to his father and showed him what he had done, expecting him to be proud. Instead, his father took the bird, now tame and trusting, in his hands, and broke its neck. "I told you to make it obedient," his father said, and dropped the falcon's lifeless body to the ground. "Instead, you taught it to love you. Falcons are not meant to be loving pets. They are fierce and wild, savage and cruel. This bird was not tamed. It was broken." Later, when his father left him, the boy cried over his pet, until eventually his father sent a servant to take the body of the bird away and bury it. The boy never cried again, and he never forgot what he'd learned: that to love is to destroy, and that to be loved is to be the one destroyed. Clary, who had been lying still, hardly breathing, rolled onto her back and opened her eyes. "That's an awful story," she said indignantly. Jace had his legs pulled up, his chin on his knees. "Is it?" he said ruminatively. "The boy's father is horrible. It's a story about child abuse." "I should have known that's what shadow hunters think a bedtime story is like. Anything that gives you screaming nightmares." "Sometimes the marks can give you screaming nightmares," said Jace, "if you get them when you're too young." He looked at her thoughtfully. The late afternoon light came in through the curtains and made his face a study in contrasts. Chiaroscuro, she thought. The art of shadows and light. "It's a good story if you think about it," he said. "The boy's father is just trying to make him stronger, inflexible." "But you have to learn to bend a little," said Clary with a yawn. Despite the story's content, the rhythm of Jace's voice had made her sleepy. "Or you'll break." "Not if you're strong enough," said Jace firmly. He reached out, and she felt the back of his hand brush her cheek. She realized her eyes were slipping shut. Exhaustion made her bones liquid. She felt as if she might wash away and vanish. As she fell into sleep, she heard the echo of words in her mind. "He gave me everything I wanted. Horses, weapons, books, even a hunting falcon." "Jace," she tried to say. But sleep had her in its claws. It drew her down, and she was silent. She was woken up by an urgent voice. "Get up!" Clary opened her eyes slowly. They felt gluey, stuck together. Something was tickling her face. It was someone's hair. She sat up quickly, and her head struck something hard. "Ow! You hit me in the head!" It was a girl's voice, Isabel. She flicked on the light next to the bed and regarded Clary resentfully, rubbing at her scalp. She seemed to shimmer in the lamplight.
She was wearing a long silvery skirt and a sequin top, and her nails were painted like glittering coins. Strands of silver beads were caught in her dark hair. She looked like a moon goddess. Clary hated her.
Well, nobody told you to lean over me like that. You practically scared me to death.
Clary rubbed at her own head. There was a sore spot just above her eyebrow.
What do you want, anyway?
Isabel indicated the dark night sky outside.
It's almost midnight. We've got to leave for the party, and you're still not dressed.
I was just going to wear this, Clary said, indicating her jeans and t-shirt ensemble.
Is that a problem?
Is that a problem?
Isabel looked like she might faint. Of course it's a problem! No downworlder would wear those clothes, and it's a party! You'll stick out like a sore thumb if you dress that casually.
She finished, looking as if the word she'd wanted to use was a lot worse than casually.
I didn't know we were dressing up, Clary said sourly. I don't have any party clothes with me.
You'll just have to borrow mine.
Oh, no. Clary thought of the two big t-shirt and jeans.
I mean, I couldn't.
Really.
Isabel's smile was as glittering as her nails.
I insist.
I'd really rather wear my own clothes, Clary protested, squirming uncomfortably as Isabel positioned her in front of the floor-length mirror in her bedroom.
Well, you can't, Isabel said. You look about 8 years old, and worse, you look like a mundane.
Clary set her jaw rebelliously.
None of your clothes are going to fit me.
We'll see about that. Clary watched Isabel in the mirror as she rifled through her closet. Her room looked as if a disco ball had exploded inside it. The walls were black and shimmered with swirls of sponged-on golden paint. Clothes were strewn everywhere. On the rumpled black bed, hung over the backs of the wooden chairs, spilling out of the closet and the tall wardrobe propped against one wall. Her vanity table, its mirror rimmed with spangled pink fur, was covered in glitter, sequins, and pots of blush and powder.
Nice room, Clary said, thinking longingly of her orange walls at home.
Thanks. I painted it myself. Isabel emerged from the closet holding something black and slinky. She tossed it at Clary. Clary held the cloth up, letting it unfold.
It looks awfully small.
It's stretchy, said Isabel. Now go put it on. Hastily, Clary retreated to the small bathroom, which was painted bright blue. She wriggled the dress on over her head. It was tight, with tiny spaghetti straps. Trying not to inhale too deeply, she returned to the bedroom, where Isabel was sitting on the bed, sliding a set of jeweled toe rings onto her sandaled feet.
You're so lucky you have such a flat chest, Isabel said. I can never wear that without a bra.
Clary scowled.
It's too short.
It's not short, it's fine, Isabel said, toeing around under the bed. She kicked out a pair of boots and some black fishnet tights. Here, you can wear these with it. They'll make you look taller.
Right, because I'm flat-chested and a midget.
Clary tugged the hem of the dress down. It just brushed the tops of her thighs. She hardly ever wore skirts, much less short ones, so seeing this much of her own legs was alarming.
If it's this short on me, how short must it be on you? She mused aloud to Isabel.
Isabel grinned.
On me, it's a shirt.
Clary flopped down on the bed and pulled the tights and boots on. The shoes were a little loose around the calves, but didn't slide around on her feet. She laced them to the top and stood up, looking at herself in the mirror. She had to admit that the combination of short black dress, fishnets, and high boots was fairly badass. The only thing that spoiled it was...
Your hair, Isabel said. It needs fixing. Desperately. Sit.
She pointed imperiously toward the vanity table. Clary sat and squinched her eyes shut as Isabel yanked her hair out of its braids, none too kindly, brushed it out, and shoved what felt like bobby pins into it. She opened her eyes just as a powder puff smacked her in the face, releasing a dense cloud of glitter. Clary coughed and glared at Isabel accusingly. The other girl laughed.
Don't look at me, look at yourself.
Glancing in the mirror, Clary saw that Isabel had pulled her hair up into an elegant swirl on the top of her head, held in place with sparkling pins. Clary was reminded suddenly of her dream, the heavy hair weighing her head down, dancing with Simon. She stirred restlessly. "Don't get up yet," Isabel said. "We're not done." She seized an eyeliner pen. "Open your eyes." Clary widened her eyes, which was good for keeping herself from crying.
"Isabel, can I ask you something?"
"Sure," said Isabel, wielding the eyeliner expertly.
"Is Alec gay?"
Isabel's wrist jerked. The eyeliner skidded, inking a long line of black from the corner of Clary's eye to her hairline. "Oh, hell," Isabel said, putting the pen down.
"It's all right," Clary began, putting her hand up to her eye.
"No, it isn't." Isabel sounded near tears as she scrabbled around among the piles of junk on top of the vanity. Eventually, she came up with a cotton ball, which she handed to Clary.
"Here, use this."
She sat down on the edge of the bed, ankle bracelets jingling, and looked at Clary through her hair.
"How did you guess?" she said finally.
You absolutely can't tell anyone," said Isabel.
"Not even Jace?"
"Especially not Jace."
"All right."
Clary heard the stiffness in her own voice.
"I guess I didn't realize it was such a big deal."
"It would be, to my parents," said Isabel quietly. "They would disown him and throw him out of the clave."
"What, you can't be gay and a shadow hunter?"
"There's no official rule about it, but people don't like it. I mean, less with people our age, I think," she added uncertainly, and Clary remembered how few other people her age Isabel had ever really met. "But the older generation, no. If it happens, you don't talk about it."
"Oh," said Clary, wishing she'd never mentioned it.
"I love my brother," said Isabel. "I'd do anything for him. But there's nothing I can do."
"At least he has you," said Clary awkwardly, and she thought for a moment of Jace, who thought of love as something that broke you into pieces. "Do you really think that Jace would mind?"
"I don't know," said Isabel in a tone that indicated she'd had enough of the topic, "but it's not my choice to make."
"I guess not," Clary said.
She leaned into the mirror, using the cotton Isabel had given her to dab away the excess eye makeup. When she sat back, she nearly dropped the cotton ball in surprise. What had Isabel done to her? Her cheekbones looked sharp and angular, her eyes deep set, mysterious, and a luminous green.
"I look like my mom," she said in surprise.
Isabel raised her eyebrows. "What? Too middle-aged? Maybe some more glitter?"
"No more glitter," Clary said hastily.
"No, it's good. I like it."
"Great."
Isabel bounced up off the bed, her anklets chiming. "Let's go."
"I need to stop by my room and grab something," Clary said, standing up.
"Also, do I need any weapons? Do you?"
"I've got plenty."
Isabel smiled, kicking her feet up so that her anklets jingled like Christmas bells. "These, for instance. The left one is gold, which is poisonous to demons, and the right one is blessed iron, in case I run across any unfriendly vampires or even fairies. Fairies hate iron. They both have strength runes carved in them, so I can pack a hell of a kick."
"Demon hunting and fashion," Clary said. "I never would have thought they went together."
Isabel laughed out loud.
"You'd be surprised."
The boys were waiting for them in the entryway. They were wearing black, even Simon, in his slightly too big pair of black pants and his own shirt turned inside out to hide the band logo. He was standing uncomfortably to the side while Jace and Alec slouched together against the wall, looking bored. Simon glanced up as Isabel strode into the entryway, her gold whip coiled around her wrist, her metal ankle chains chiming like bells. Clary expected him to look stunned. Isabel did look amazing. But his eyes slid past her to Clary, where they rested with a look of astonishment.
"What is that?" he demanded, straightening up. "That you're wearing, I mean."
Clary looked down at herself. She'd thrown a light jacket on to make her feel less naked and grabbed her backpack from her room.
It was slung over her shoulder, bumping familiarly between her shoulder blades. But Simon wasn't looking at her backpack. He was looking at her legs as if he'd never seen them before.
"It's a dress, Simon," Clary said dryly. "I know I don't wear them that much, but really."
"It's so short," he said in confusion. Even half in Demon Hunter clothes, Clary thought, he looked like the sort of boy who'd come over to your house to pick you up for a date and be polite to your parents and nice to your pets. Jace, on the other hand, looked like the sort of boy who'd come over to your house and burn it down for kicks.
"I like the dress," he said, unhitching himself from the wall.
His eyes ran up and down her lazily, like the stroking paws of a cat.
"It needs a little something extra, though."
"So now you're a fashion expert?" Her voice came out unevenly. He was standing very close to her, close enough that she could feel the warmth of him, smell the faint burned scent of newly applied marks. He took something out of his jacket and handed it to her. It was a long, thin dagger in a leather sheath. The hilt of the dagger was set with a single red stone carved in the shape of a rose. She shook her head.
"I wouldn't even know how to use that."
He pressed it into her hand, curling her fingers around it.
"You'd learn."
He dropped his voice.
"It's in your blood."
She drew her hand back slowly.
"All right.
I could give you a thigh sheath to put that in," Isabel offered. "I've got tons."
"Certainly not," said Simon.
Clary shot him an irritated look.
"Thanks, but I'm not really a thigh sheath kind of girl."
She slid the dagger into the outside pocket of her backpack. She looked up from closing it to find Jace watching her through hooded eyes.
"And one last thing," he said.
He reached over and pulled the sparkling pins out of her hair so that it fell in warm and heavy curls down her neck. The sensation of hair tickling her bare skin was unfamiliar and oddly pleasant.
"Much better," he said, and she thought this time that maybe his voice was slightly uneven too.
12. Dead Man's Party. The directions on the invitation took them to a largely industrial neighborhood in Brooklyn whose streets were lined with factories and warehouses. Some, Clary could see, had been converted into lofts and galleries, but there was still something forbidding about their looming square shapes, boasting only a few windows covered in iron grills. They made their way from the subway station, Isabel navigating with the sensor, which seemed to have a sort of mapping system built in. Simon, who loved gadgets, was fascinated, or at least he was pretending it was the sensor he was fascinated with. Hoping to avoid them, Clary lagged behind as they crossed through a scrubby park, its badly kept grass burned brown by the summer heat. To her right, the spires of a church gleamed gray and black against the starless night sky.
"Keep up," said an irritable voice in her ear.
It was Jace, who had dropped back to walk beside her.
"I don't want to have to keep looking behind me to make sure nothing's happened to you."
"So don't bother. Last time I left you alone, a demon attacked you," he pointed out. "Well, I'd certainly hate to interrupt your pleasant night stroll with my sudden death." He blinked. "There is a fine line between sarcasm and outright hostility, and you seem to have crossed it. What's up?" She bit her lip. "This morning, weird creepy guys dug around in my brain. Now I'm going to meet the weird creepy guy who originally dug around in my brain? What if I don't like what he finds?"
"What makes you think you won't?"
Clary pulled her hair away from her sticky skin. "I hate it when you answer a question with a question."
"No, you don't. You think it's charming.
Anyway, wouldn't you rather know the truth?"
"No. I mean, maybe. I don't know."
She sighed.
"Would you?"
"This is the right street," called Isabel a quarter of a block ahead. They were on a narrow avenue lined with old warehouses, though most now bore the signs of human residence. Window boxes filled with flowers, lace curtains blowing in the clammy night breeze, numbered plastic trash cans stacked on the sidewalk. Clary squinted hard, but there was no way to tell if this was the street she'd seen at the Bone City. In her vision, it had been nearly obliterated with snow. She felt Jace's fingers brush her shoulder.
"Absolutely. Always," he murmured.
She looked sideways at him, not understanding.
What?
The truth, he said. I would...
Jace!
It was Alec. He was standing on the pavement, not far away. Clary wondered why his voice had sounded so loud. Jace turned, his hand falling away from her shoulder.
Yes? Think we're in the right place?
Alec was pointing at something Clary couldn't see. It was hidden behind the bulk of a large black car.
What's that?
Jace joined Alec. Clary heard him laugh. Coming around the car, she saw what they were looking at. Several motorcycles, sleek and silvery, with low-slung black chassis. Oily-looking tubes and pipes slithered up and around them, ropey as veins. There was a queasy sense of something organic about the bikes, like the bio-creatures in a Giger painting.
Vampires, Jace said.
They look like motorcycles to me, said Simon, joining them with Isabel at his side. She frowned at the bikes.
They are, but they've been altered to run on demon energies, she explained. Vampires use them. It lets them get around fast at night. It's not strictly Covenant, but...
I've heard some of the bikes can fly, said Alec eagerly.
He sounded like Simon with the new video game.
Or go invisible at the flick of a switch. Or operate underwater.
Jace had jumped down off the curb and was circling the bikes, examining them. He reached out a hand and stroked one of the bikes along the sleek chassis. It had words painted along the side in silver. Nox Invictus.
Victorious Knight, he translated.
Alec was looking at him strangely.
What are you doing?
Clary thought she saw Jay slide his hand back inside his jacket.
Nothing.
Well, hurry up, said Isabel. I didn't get this dressed up to watch you mess around in the gutter with a bunch of motorcycles.
They are pretty to look at, said Jace, hopping back up on the pavement.
You have to admit that.
So am I, said Isabel, who didn't look inclined to admit anything. Now hurry up. Jace was looking at Clary.
This building, he said, pointing at the red brick warehouse. Is this the one?
Clary exhaled.
I think so, she said uncertainly. They all look the same.
One way to find out, said Isabel, mounting the steps with a determined stride. The rest of them followed, crowding close to one another in the foul-smelling entryway. A naked bulb hung from a cord overhead, illuminating a large metal-bound door and a row of apartment buzzers along the left wall. Only one had a name written over it. Bane. Isabel pressed the buzzer. Nothing happened. She pressed it again. She was about to press it a third time when Alec caught her wrist.
Don't be rude, he said.
She glared at him. Alec! The door flew open. A slender man standing in the doorway regarded them curiously. It was Isabel who recovered herself first, flashing a brilliant smile.
Magnus? Magnus Bane?
That would be me.
The man blocking the doorway was as tall and thin as a rail, his hair a crown of dense black spikes. Clary guessed from the curve of his sleepy eyes and the gold tone of his evenly tanned skin that he was part Asian. He wore jeans and a black shirt covered with dozens of metal buckles. His eyes were crusted with a raccoon mask of charcoal glitter, his lips painted a dark shade of blue. He raked a ring-laden hand through his spiked hair and regarded them thoughtfully.
Children of the Nephilim, he said.
Well, well, I don't recall inviting you. Isabel took out her invitation and waved it like a white flag.
I have an invitation. These, she indicated the rest of the group with a grand wave of her arm, are my friends.
Magnus plucked the invitation out of her hand and looked at it with fastidious distaste.
I must have been drunk, he said.
He threw the door open.
Come in,
and try not to murder any of my guests.
Jace edged into the doorway, sizing up Magnus with his eyes.
Even if one of them spills a drink on my new shoes?
Even then.
Magnus's hand shot out so fast it was barely a blur. He plucked the stele out of Jace's hand. Clary hadn't even realized he was holding it, and held it up. Jace looked faintly abashed.
As for this, Magnus said, sliding it into Jace's jeans pocket,
Keep it in your pants, Shadow Hunter.
Magnus grinned and started up the stairs, leaving a surprised-looking Jace holding the door.
Come on, he said, waving the rest of them inside, before anyone thinks it's my party.
They pushed past Jace, laughing nervously. Only Isabel stopped to shake her head.
Try not to piss him off, please, then he won't help us.
Jace looked bored. I know what I'm doing.
I hope so.
Isabel flounced past him in a swirl of skirts. Magnus's apartment was at the top of a long flight of rickety stairs. Simon hurried to catch up with Clary, who was regretting having put her hand on the banister to steady herself. It was sticky with something that glowed a faint and sickly green.
Yuck,
said Simon, and offered her a corner of his t-shirt to wipe her hand on. She did.
Is everything all right? You seem distracted.
He just looks so familiar. Magnus, I mean.
You think he goes to St. Xavier's?
Very funny.
She looked at him sourly.
You're right, he's too old to be a student. I think I had him for chem last year.
Clary laughed out loud. Immediately, Isabel was beside her, breathing down her neck.
Am I missing something funny? Simon?
Simon had the grace to look embarrassed, but said nothing. Clary muttered,
You're not missing anything, and dropped behind them.
Isabel's lug-soled boots were starting to hurt her feet. By the time she reached the top of the stairs, she was limping, but she forgot the pain as soon as she walked through Magnus's front door. The loft was huge and almost totally empty of furniture. Floor-to-ceiling windows were smeared with a thick film of dirt and paint, blocking out most of the ambient light from the street. Big metal pillars wound with colored lights held up an arched, sooty ceiling. Doors torn off their hinges and laid across dented metal garbage cans made a makeshift bar at one end of the room. A lilac-skinned woman in a metallic bustier was ranging drinks along the bar in tall, harshly colored glasses that tinted the fluid inside them. Blood red, cyanosis blue, poison green. Even for a New York bartender, she worked with an amazingly speedy efficiency, probably helped along by the fact that she had a second set of long, graceful arms to go with the first. Clary was reminded of Luke's Indian goddess statue. The rest of the crowd was just as strange. A good-looking boy with wet, green-black hair grinned at her over a platter of what looked like raw fish. His teeth were sharp and serrated like a shark's. Beside him stood a girl with long, dirty blonde hair braided with flowers. Under the skirt of her short green dress, her feet were webbed like a frog's. A group of young women so pale Clary wondered if they were wearing white stage makeup sipped scarlet liquid too thick to be wine from fluted crystal glasses. The center of the room was packed with bodies dancing to the pounding beat that bounced off the walls, though Clary couldn't see a band anywhere.
You like the party?
She turned to see Magnus lounging against one of the pillars. His eyes shone in the darkness. Glancing around, she saw that Jace and the others were gone, swallowed up by the crowd. She tried to smile.
Is it in honor of anything?
My cat's birthday.
Oh, she glanced around.
Where's your cat?
He unhitched himself from the pillar, looking solemn.
I don't know. He ran away.
Clary was spared responding to this by the reappearance of Jace and Alec. Alec looked sullen as usual. Jace was wearing a strand of tiny glowing flowers around his neck and seemed pleased with himself. Where are Simon and Isabel? Clary said.
On the dance floor.
He pointed. She could just see them on the edge of the packed square of bodies. Simon was doing what he usually did in lieu of dancing, which was to bounce up and down on the balls of his feet, looking uncomfortable. Isabel was slinking in a circle around him, sinuous as a snake, trailing her fingers across his chest. She was looking at him as if she were planning to drag him off into a corner to have sex. Clary hugged her arms around herself, her bracelets clanking together. If they dance any closer together, they won't have to go off in a corner to have sex.
Look, Jay said, turning to Magnus. We really need to talk to
Magnus Bane?
The deep, booming voice belonged to a surprisingly short man who looked to be in his early 30s. He was compactly muscular, with a bald head shaved smooth and a pointed goatee. He leveled a trembling finger at Magnus.
Someone just poured holy water into the gas tank on my bike. It's ruined, destroyed, all the pipes are melted.
Melted? Murmured Magnus. How dreadful.
I want to know who did it.
The man bared his teeth, showing long pointed canines. Clary stared in fascination. They didn't look at all the way she'd imagined vampire fangs. These were as thin and sharp as needles.
I thought you'd swore there'd be no wolfmen here tonight, Bane.
I invited none of the moon's children, Magnus said, examining his glittery nails. Precisely because of your stupid little feud. If any of them decided to sabotage your bike, they weren't a guest of mine and are therefore, he offered a winsome smile, not my responsibility.
The vampire roared with rage, jabbing his finger toward Magnus.
Are you trying to tell me that?
Magnus's glitter-coated index finger twitched just a fraction, so slightly that Clary almost thought he hadn't moved at all. Mid-roar, the vampire gagged and clutched at his throat. His mouth worked, but no sound came out.
You've worn out your welcome, Magnus said lazily, opening his eyes very wide.
Clary saw with a jolt of surprise that they had vertical slit pupils like a cat's.
Now go.
He splayed the fingers of his hand, and the vampire turned as smartly as if someone had grabbed his shoulders and spun him around. He marched back into the crowd, heading toward the door. Jace whistled under his breath.
That was impressive.
You mean that little hissy fit?
Magnus cast his eyes toward the ceiling.
I know. What is her problem?
Alec made a choking noise. After a moment, Clary recognized it as laughter. He ought to do that more often.
We put the holy water in his gas tank, you know, he said.
Alec, said Jace, shut up.
I assumed that, said Magnus, looking amused.
Vindictive little bastards, aren't you?
You know, their bikes run on demon energies.
I doubt he'll be able to repair it.
One less leech with a fancy ride, said Jace. My heart bleeds.
I heard some of them can make their bikes fly, put in Alec, who looked animated for once. He was almost smiling.
Merely an old witch's tale, said Magnus, his cat's eyes glittering.
So, is that why you wanted to crash my party? Just to wreck some bloodsucker bikes?
No. Jace was all business again. We need to talk to you, preferably somewhere private.
Magnus raised an eyebrow. Damn, Clary thought, another one.
Am I in trouble with the Clave?
No, said Jace.
Probably not, said Alec.
Ow!
He glared at Jace, who had kicked him sharply in the ankle.
No, Jace repeated. We can talk to you under the seal of the Covenant. If you help us, anything you say will be confidential.
And if I don't help you?
Jace spread his hands wide. The rune tattoos on his palms stood out stark and black.
Maybe nothing. Maybe a visit from the Silent City.
Magnus's voice was honey poured over shards of ice.
That's quite a choice you're offering me, little shadow hunter.
It's no choice at all, said Jace.
Yes, said the warlock. That's exactly what I meant.
Magnus's bedroom was a riot of color. Canary yellow sheets and bedspread draped over a mattress on the floor. Electric blue vanity table strewn with more pots of paint and makeup than Isabel's. Rainbow velvet curtains hid the floor-to-ceiling windows, and a tangled wool rug covered the floor.
Nice place, said Jace, drawing aside a heavy swag of curtain. Guess it pays well, being the high warlock of Brooklyn.
It pays, Magnus said. Not much of a benefit package, though. No dental.
He shut the door behind him and leaned against it. When he crossed his arms, his t-shirt rode up, showing a strip of flat golden stomach unmarked by a navel.
So, he said, what's on your devious little minds?
It's not them, actually, Clary said, finding her voice before Jace could reply.
I'm the one who wanted to talk to you. Magnus turned his inhuman eyes on her. You are not one of them, he said. Not of the Clave. But you can see the invisible world. My mother was one of the Clave, Clary said. It was the first time she'd said it out loud and known it to be true. But she never told me. She kept it a secret. I don't know why. So ask her. I can't. She's... Clary hesitated. She's gone. And your father? He died before I was born. Magnus exhaled irritably. As Oscar Wilde once said, to lose one parent may be regarded as misfortune. To lose both seems like carelessness. Clary heard Jace make a small hissing sound, like air being sucked through his teeth. She said, I didn't lose my mother. She was taken from me by Valentine. I don't know any Valentine, said Magnus, but his eyes flickered like wavering candle flames, and Clary knew he was lying. I'm sorry for your tragic circumstances, but I fail to see what any of this has to do with me. If you could tell me... She can't tell you because she doesn't remember, Jace said sharply. Someone erased her memories, so he went to the Silent City to see what the brothers could pull out of her head. They got two words. I think you can guess what they were. There was a short silence. Finally, Magnus let his mouth turn up at the corner. His smile was bitter. My signature, he said. I knew it was folly when I did it, an act of hubris. You signed my mind? Clary said in disbelief. Magnus raised his hand, tracing the fiery outlines of letters against the air. When he dropped his hand, they hung there, hot and golden, making the painted lines of his eyes and mouth burn with reflected light. Magnus Bane. I was proud of my work on you, he said slowly, looking at Clary. So clean, so perfect. What you saw, you would forget, even as you saw it. No image of pixie or goblin or long-legged beastie would remain to trouble your blameless mortal sleep. It was the way she wanted it. Clary's voice was thin with tension. The way who wanted it? Magnus sighed, and at the touch of his breath, the fire letters sifted away to glowing ash. Finally, he spoke, and though she was not surprised, though she had known exactly what he was going to say, still she felt the words like a blow against her heart. Your mother, he said. 13. The Memory of Whiteness. My mother did this to me? Clary demanded, but her surprised outrage didn't sound convincing, even to her own ears. Looking around, she saw pity in Jace's eyes, in Alex. Even Alec had guessed and felt sorry for her. Why? I don't know. Magnus spread his long white hands. It's not my job to ask questions. I do what I get paid to do. Within the bounds of the covenant, Jace reminded him, his voice soft as cat's fur. Magnus inclined his head. Within the bounds of the covenant, of course. So the covenant's all right with this? This mind rape? Clary asked bitterly. When no one answered, she sank down on the edge of Magnus's bed. Was it only once? Was there something specific she wanted me to forget? Do you know what it was? Magnus paced restlessly to the window. I don't think you understand. The first time I ever saw you, you must have been about 2 years old, I was watching out this window. He tapped the glass, freeing a shower of dust and paint chips. And I saw her hurrying up the street, holding something wrapped in a blanket. I was surprised when she stopped at my door. She looked so ordinary, so young. The moonlight touched his hawkish profile with silver. She unwrapped the blanket when she came in my door. You were inside it. She set you down on the floor and you started ranging around, picking things up, pulling my cat's tail. You screamed like a banshee when the cat scratched you, so I asked your mother if you were part banshee. She didn't laugh. He paused. They were all watching him intently now, even Alec.
She told me she was a shadow hunter. There was no point in her lying about it. Covenant marks show up even when they've faded with time, like faint silver scars against the skin. They flickered when she moved. He rubbed at the glitter makeup around his eyes. She told me she'd hoped she'd been born with a blind inner eye. Some shadow hunters have to be taught to see the shadow world. But she'd caught you that afternoon, teasing a pixie trapped in a hedge. She knew you could see. So, she asked me if it was possible to blind you of the sight. Clary made a little noise, a pained exhalation of breath, but Magnus went on remorselessly. I told her that crippling that part of your mind might leave you damaged, possibly insane. She didn't cry. She wasn't the sort of woman who weeps easily, your mother. She asked me if there was another way, and I told her you could be made to forget those parts of the shadow world that you could see, even as you saw them. The only caveat was that she'd have to come to me every 2 years as the results of the spell began to fade. And did she? Asked Clary. Magnus nodded. I've seen you every 2 years since that first time. I've watched you grow up. You're the only child I have ever watched grow up that way, you know. In my business, one isn't generally that welcome around human children. So you recognized Clary when we walked in, Jay said. You must have. Of course I did. Magnus sounded exasperated. And it was a shock, too. But what would you have done? She didn't know me. She wasn't supposed to know me. Just the fact that she was here meant the spell had started to fade, and in fact, we were due for another visit about a month ago. I even came by your house when I got back from Tanzania, but Jocelyn said that you two had had a fight and you'd run off. She said she'd call on me when you came back, but... An elegant shrug. She never did. A cold wash of memory prickled Clary's skin. She remembered standing in the foyer next to Simon, straining to remember something that danced just at the edge of her vision. I thought I saw Dorothea's cat, but it was just a trick of the light. But Dorothea didn't have a cat. You were there that day, Clary said. I saw you coming out of Dorothea's apartment. I remember your eyes. Magnus looked as if he might purr. I'm memorable. It's true, he gloated. Then he shook his head. You shouldn't remember me, he said. I threw up a glamour as hard as a wall as soon as I saw you. You should have run right into it face first, psychically speaking. If you run into a psychic wall face first, do you wind up with psychic bruises? Clary thought. If you take the spell off me, will I be able to remember all the things I've forgotten? All the memories you stole? I can't take it off you. Magnus looked uncomfortable. What? Jay sounded furious. Why not? The clave requires you. Magnus looked at him coldly. I don't like being told what to do, little shadow hunter. Clary could see how much Jace disliked being referred to as little, but before he could snap out a reply, Alex spoke. His voice was soft, thoughtful. Don't you know how to reverse it? He asked. The spell, I mean. Magnus sighed. Undoing a spell is a great deal more difficult than creating it in the first place. The intricacy of this one, the care I put into weaving it, if I made even the smallest mistake in unraveling it, her mind could be damaged forever. Besides, he added, it's already begun to fade. The effects will vanish over time on their own. Clary looked at him sharply. Will I get all my memories back then? Whatever was taken out of my head? I don't know. They might come back all at once, or in stages, or you might never remember what you've forgotten over the years. What your mother asked me to do was unique, in my experience. I've no idea what will happen. But I don't want to wait. Clary folded her hands tightly in her lap, her fingers clamped together so hard that the tips turned white. All my life I felt like there was something wrong with me, something missing or damaged. Now I know I didn't damage you. It was Magnus's turn to interrupt. his lips curled back angrily to show sharp white teeth. Every teenager in the world feels like that, feels broken or out of place, different somehow. Royalty mistakenly born into a family of peasants. The difference in your case is that it's true. You are different. Maybe not better, but different. And it's no picnic being different. You want to know what it's like when your parents are good church-going folk and you happen to be born with the devil's mark? He pointed at his eyes, fingers splayed. When your father flinches at the sight of you and your mother hangs herself in the barn, driven mad by what she's done? When I was 10, my father tried to drown me in the creek. I lashed out at him with everything I had, burned him where he stood. I went to the fathers of the church eventually for sanctuary. They hid me. They say that pity is a bitter thing, but it's better than hate. When I found out what I really was, only half a human being, I hated myself. Anything's better than that. There was silence when Magnus was done speaking. To Clary's surprise, it was Alec who broke it. It wasn't your fault, he said. You can't help how you're born. Magnus's expression was closed. I'm over it, he said. I think you get my point. Different isn't better, Clarissa. Your mother was trying to protect you. Don't throw it back in her face. Clary's hands relaxed their grip on each other. I don't care if I'm different, she said. I just want to be who I really am. Magnus swore in a language she didn't know. It sounded like crackling flames. All right, listen. I can't undo what I've done, but I can give you something else. A piece of what would have been yours if you'd been raised a true child of the Nephilim. He stalked across the room to the bookcase and dragged down a heavy volume bound in rotting green velvet. He flipped through the pages, shedding dust and bits of blackened cloth. The pages were thin, almost translucent eggshell parchment, each marked with a stark black rune. Jace's eyebrows went up. Is that a copy of the Grey Book? Magnus, feverishly flipping pages, said nothing. Hodge has one, Alec observed. He showed it to me once. It's not gray, Clary felt compelled to point out. It's green. If there was such a thing as terminal literalism, you'd have died in childhood, said Jace, brushing dust off the windowsill and eyeing it as if considering whether it was clean enough to sit on. Gray is short for grammary. It means magic hidden wisdom. In it is copied every rune the angel Raziel wrote in the original Book of the Covenant. There aren't many copies because each one has to be specially made. Some of the runes are so powerful they'd burn through regular pages. Alec looked impressed. I didn't know all that. Jace hopped up on the windowsill and swung his legs. Not all of us sleep through history lessons. I do not. Oh, yes, you do, and drool on the desk besides. Shut up, said Magnus, but he said it quite mildly. He hooked his finger between two pages of the book and came over to Clary, setting it carefully in her lap. Now, when I open the book, I want you to study the page. Look at it until you feel something change inside your mind. Will it hurt? Clary asked nervously. All knowledge hurts, he replied, and stood up, letting the book fall open in her lap. Clary stared down at the clean white page with the black rune mark spilled across it. It looked something like a winged spiral, until she tilted her head, and then it seemed like a staff wound around with vines. The mutable corners of the pattern tickled her mind like feathers brushed against sensitive skin. She felt the shivery flicker of reaction, making her want to close her eyes, but she held them open until they stung and blurred. She was about to blink when she felt it, a click inside her head like a key turning in a lock. The rune on the page seemed to spring into sharp focus, and she thought involuntarily, remember. If the rune were a word, it would have been that one, but there was more meaning to it than any word she could imagine. It was a child's first memory of light falling through crib bars, the recollected scent of rain and city streets, the pain of unforgotten loss, the sting of remembered humiliation, and the cruel forgetfulness of old age when the most ancient of memories stand out with agonizingly clear precision and the nearest of incidents are lost beyond recall. With a little sigh, she turned to the next page and the next, letting the images and sensations flow over her. Sorrow. Thought. Strength. Protection. Grace. And then cried out in reproachful surprise as Magnus snatched the book off her lap. "That's enough," he said, sliding it back onto its shelf. He dusted his hands off on his colorful pants, leaving streaks of gray. "If you read all the runes at once, you'll give yourself a headache." But most Shadowhunter children grow up learning one rune at a time over a period of years, said Jace. "The gray book contains runes even I don't know."
"Imagine that," said Magnus.
Jace ignored him. "Magnus showed you the rune for understanding and remembrance. It opens your mind up to reading and recognizing the rest of the marks."
"It also may serve as a trigger to activate dormant memories," said Magnus. "They could return to you more quickly than they would otherwise. It's the best I can do."
Clary looked down at her lap. "I still don't remember anything about the mortal cup."
"Is that what this is about?" Magnus sounded actually astonished. "You're after the angel's cup?"
"Look, I've been through your memories. There was nothing in them about the mortal instruments."
"Mortal instruments?" Clary echoed, bewildered. "I thought..."
"The angel gave 3 items to the first shadow hunters: a cup, a sword, and a mirror. The Silent Brothers have the sword. The cup and the mirror were in Idris, at least until Valentine came along."
"Nobody knows where the mirror is," said Alec. "Nobody's known for ages."
"It's the cup that concerns us," said Jace. "Valentine's looking for it."
"And you want to get to it before he does?" Magnus asked, his eyebrows winging upward.
"I thought you said you didn't know who Valentine was," Clary pointed out.
"I lied," Magnus admitted candidly. "I'm not one of the Fae, you know. I'm not required to be truthful. And only a fool would get between Valentine and his revenge."
"Is that what you think he's after?"
"Revenge?" said Jace.
"I would guess so. He suffered a grave defeat, and he hardly seems, the type of man to suffer defeat gracefully."
Alec looked harder at Magnus. "Were you at the uprising?"
Magnus's eyes locked with Alec's.
"I was.
I killed a number of your folk."
"Circle members," said Jace quickly. "Not ours.
If you insist on disavowing that which is ugly about what you do," said Magnus, still looking at Alec, "you will never learn from your mistakes."
Alec, plucking at the coverlet with one hand, flushed an unhappy red.
"You don't seem surprised to hear that Valentine's still alive," he said, avoiding Magnus's gaze.
Magnus spread his hands wide.
"Are you?"
Jace opened his mouth, then closed it again. He looked actually baffled. Eventually, he said, "So you won't help us find the mortal cup?"
"I wouldn't if I could," said Magnus, "which, by the way, I can't. I've no idea where it is, and I don't care to know. Only a fool, as I said."
Alec sat up straighter.
"But without the cup, we can't..."
"Make more of you, I know," said Magnus. "Perhaps not everyone regards that as quite the disaster you do.
Mind you," he added, "if I had to choose between the Clave and Valentine, I would choose the Clave. At least they're not actually sworn to wipe out my kind. But nothing the Clave has done has earned my unswerving loyalty either. So no, I'll sit this one out. Now, if we're done here, I'd like to get back to my party before any of the guests eat each other."
Jace, who was clenching and unclenching his hands, looked like he was about to say something furious, but Alec, standing up, put a hand on his shoulder. Clary couldn't quite tell in the dimness, but it looked as if Alec was squeezing rather hard.
"Is that likely?" he asked.
Magnus was looking at him with some amusement.
"It's happened before."
Jace muttered something to Alec, who let go. Detaching himself, he came over to Clary.
"Are you all right?" he asked in a low voice.
"I think so. I don't feel any different."
Magnus, standing by the door, snapped his fingers impatiently. "Move it along, teenagers. The only person who gets to canoodle in my bedroom is my magnificent self."
"Canoodle?" repeated Clary, never having heard the word before.
Magnificent, repeated Jace, who was just being nasty. Magnus growled. The growl sounded like, get out. They got, Magnus trailing behind them as he paused to lock the bedroom door. The tenor of the party seemed subtly different to Clary. Perhaps it was just her slightly altered vision. Everything seemed clearer, crystalline edges sharply defined. She watched a group of musicians take the small stage at the center of the room. They wore flowing garments in deep colors of gold, purple, and green, and their high voices were sharp and ethereal. I hate fairy bands, Magnus muttered as the musicians segued into another haunting song, the melody as delicate and translucent as rock crystal. All they ever play is mopey ballads. Jace, glancing around the room, laughed. Where's Isabel? A rush of guilty concern hit Clary. She'd forgotten about Simon. She spun around, looking for the familiar skinny shoulders and shock of dark hair. I don't see him. Them, I mean. There she is. Alex spotted his sister and waved her over, looking relieved. Over here, and watch out for the puka. Watch out for the puka, Jace repeated, glancing toward a thin, brown-skinned man in a green paisley vest who eyed Isabel thoughtfully as she walked by. He pinched me when I passed him earlier, Alex said stiffly. In a highly personal area. I hate to break it to you, but if he's interested in your highly personal areas, he probably isn't interested in your sister's. Not necessarily, said Magnus. Fairies aren't particular. Jace curled his lip scornfully in the warlock's direction. You still here? Before Magnus could reply, Isabel was on top of them, looking pink-faced and blotchy and smelling strongly of alcohol.
Jace! Alec! Where have you been? I've been looking all over.
Where's Simon? Clary interrupted. Isabel wobbled. He's a rat, she said darkly. Did he do something to you? Alec was full of brotherly concern. Did he touch you? If he tried anything?
No, Alec, Isabel said irritably. Not like that. He is a rat.
She's drunk, said Jace, beginning to turn away in disgust.
I'm not, Isabel said indignantly. Well, maybe a little, but that's not the point. The point is, Simon drank one of those blue drinks. I told him not to, but he didn't listen, and he turned into a rat.
A rat? Clary repeated incredulously. You don't mean...
I mean a rat, Isabel said. Little, brown, scaly tail.
The Clave isn't gonna like this, said Alec dubiously. I'm pretty sure turning mundanes into rats is against the law. Technically, she didn't turn him into a rat, Jace pointed out. The worst she could be accused of is negligence.
Who cares about the stupid law? Clary screamed, grabbing hold of Isabel's wrist. My best friend is a rat.
Ouch!
Isabel tried to pull her wrist back.
Let go of me.
Not until you tell me where he is. She never wanted to smack anyone as much as she wanted to smack Isabel right at that moment. I can't believe you just left him. He's probably terrified.
If he hasn't been stepped on, Jace pointed out unhelpfully.
I didn't leave him. He ran under the bar,
Isabel protested, pointing.
Let go. You're denting my bracelet.
Bitch, Clary said savagely and flung a surprised-looking Isabel's hand back at her hard. She didn't stop for a reaction. She was running toward the bar. Dropping to her knees, she peered into the dark space under it. In the moldy-smelling gloom, she thought she could just detect a pair of glinting, beady eyes.
Simon, she said, her voice choked. Is that you?
Simon the rat crept forward slightly, his whiskers trembling. She could see the shape of his small rounded ears, flat against his head, and the sharp point of his nose. She fought down a feeling of revulsion. She'd never liked rats with their yellowy, squared-off teeth all ready to bite.
She'd wished he'd turn into a hamster.
"It's me, Clary," she said slowly. "Are you okay?"
Jace and the others arrived behind her, Isabel looking more annoyed now than tearful. "Is he under there?" Jace asked curiously. Clary, still on her hands and knees, nodded.
"She'll frighten him off."
She pushed her fingers gingerly under the edge of the bar and wiggled them.
"Please come out, Simon. We'll get Magnus to reverse the spell. It'll be okay."
She heard a squeak, and the rat's pink nose poked out from beneath the bar. With an exclamation of relief, Clary seized the rat in her hands.
"Simon, you understood me."
The rat, huddled in the hollow of her palms, squeaked glumly. Delighted, she hugged him to her chest.
"Oh, poor baby,"
she crooned, almost as if he really were a pet.
"Poor Simon, it'll be fine, I promise."
"I wouldn't feel too sorry for him," Jace said. "That's probably the closest he's ever gotten to second base."
"Shut up!"
Clary glared at Jace furiously, but she did loosen her grip on the rat. His whiskers were trembling, whether in anger or agitation or simple terror, she couldn't tell. "Get Magnus," she said sharply. "We have to turn him back."
"Let's not be hasty."
Jace was actually grinning, the bastard. He reached toward Simon as if he meant to pet him. "He's cute like that. Look at his little pink nose." Simon bared long yellow teeth at Jace and made a snapping motion. Jace pulled his outstretched hand back. "Izzy, go fetch our magnificent host."
"Why me?" Isabel looked petulant.
"Because it's your fault the mundane's a rat, idiot," he said, and Clary was struck by how rarely any of them, other than Isabel, ever said Simon's actual name. "And we can't leave him here."
"You'd be happy to leave him if it weren't for her,"
Isabel said, managing to inject the single-syllable word with enough venom to poison an elephant. She stalked off, her skirt flouncing around her hips.
"I can't believe she let you drink that blue drink," Clary said to Rat Simon. "Now you see what you get for being so shallow."
Simon squeaked irritably. Clary heard someone chuckle and glanced up to see Magnus leaning over her. Isabel stood behind him, her expression furious.
"Ratus norvegicus," said Magnus, peering at Simon.
"A common brown rat, nothing exotic." "I don't care what kind of rat he is," Clary said crossly. "I want him turned back." Magnus scratched his head thoughtfully, shedding glitter.
"No point," he said.
"That's what I said." Jace looked pleased.
"No point!"
Clary shouted so loudly that Simon hid his head under her thumb.
"How can you say there's no point?"
"Because he'll turn back on his own in a few hours," said Magnus. "The effect of the cocktails is temporary. No point working up a transformation spell. It'll just traumatize him. Too much magic is hard on mundanes. Their systems aren't used to it."
"I doubt his system is used to being a rat either," Clary pointed out. "You're a warlock. Can't you just reverse the spell?"
Magnus considered.
"No,"
he said.
"You mean you won't?"
"Not for free, darling, and you can't afford me."
"I can't take a rat home on the subway either," Clary said plaintively. "I'll drop him, or one of the MTA police will arrest me for transporting pests on the transit system."
Simon chirped his annoyance. "Not that you're a pest, of course." A girl who had been shouting by the door was now joined by 6 or 7 others. The sound of angry voices rose above the hum of the party and the strains of the music. Magnus rolled his eyes. "Excuse me," he said, backing into the crowd, which closed behind him instantly. Isabel, wobbling on her sandals, expelled a gusty sigh.
"So much for his help."
"You know," Alex said, "you could always put the rat in your backpack." Clary looked at him hard, but couldn't find anything wrong with the idea. It wasn't as if she had a pocket she could have tucked him in. Isabel's clothes didn't allow for pockets. They were too tight. Clary was amazed they allowed for Isabel. Shrugging off her pack, she found a hiding place for the small brown rat that had once been Simon, nestled between her rolled-up sweater and her sketch pad. He curled up atop her wallet, looking reproachful.
"I'm sorry," she said miserably.
"Don't bother," Jace said. "Why mundanes always insist on taking responsibility for things that aren't their fault is a mystery to me. You didn't force that cocktail down his idiotic throat."
"If it weren't for me, he wouldn't have been here at all," Clary said in a small voice.
"Don't flatter yourself. He came because of Isabel." Angrily, Clary jerked the top of the bag closed and stood up. "Let's get out of here. I'm sick of this place." The tight knot of shouting people by the door turned out to be more vampires, easily recognizable by the pallor of their skin and the dead blackness of their hair. They must dye it, Clary thought. They couldn't possibly all be naturally dark-haired, and besides, some of them had blonde eyebrows. They were loudly complaining about their vandalized motorbikes and the fact that some of their friends were missing and unaccounted for. "They're probably drunk and passed out somewhere," Magnus said, waving long white fingers in a bored manner. "You know how you lot tend to turn into bats and piles of dust when you've downed a few too many Bloody Marys." "They mix their vodka with real blood," Jace said in Clary's ear. The pressure of his breath made her shiver. "Yes, I got that, thanks." "We can't go around picking up every pile of dust in the place just in case it turns out to be Gregor in the morning," said a girl with a sulky mouth and painted-on eyebrows.
"Gregor will be fine. I rarely sweep," soothed Magnus.
"I am happy to send any stragglers back to the hotel come tomorrow, in a car with blacked-out windows, of course."
"But what about our motorbikes?" said a thin boy whose blonde roots showed under his bad dye job. A gold earring in the shape of a stake hung from his left earlobe.
"It'll take hours to fix them."
"You've got until sunrise," said Magnus, temper visibly fraying. "I suggest you get started." He raised his voice.
"All right, that's it. Party's over. Everybody out."
He waved his arms, shedding glitter. With a single loud twang, the band ceased playing. A drone of loud complaint rose from the partygoers, but they moved obediently toward the doorway. None of them stopped to thank Magnus for the party.
"Come on." Jace pushed Clary toward the exit.
The crowd was dense. She held her backpack in front of her, hands wrapped protectively around it. Someone bumped her shoulder, hard, and she yelped and moved sideways away from Jace. A hand brushed her backpack. She looked up and saw the vampire with the stake earring grinning at her.
"Hey, pretty thing," he said. "What's in the bag?"
"Holy water," said Jace, reappearing beside her as if he'd been conjured up like a genie. A sarcastic blonde genie with a bad attitude.
"Ooh, a shadow hunter," said the vampire. "Scary."
With a wink, he melted back into the crowd.
"Vampires are such prima donnas," Magnus sighed from the doorway. "Honestly, I don't know why I have these parties."
"Because of your cat," Clary reminded him.
Magnus perked up. "That's true. Chairman Meow deserves my every effort."
He glanced at her and the tight knot of shadow hunters just behind her.
"You on your way out?"
Jace nodded. "Don't want to overstay a welcome."
"What welcome?" Magnus asked. "I'd say it was a pleasure to meet you, but it wasn't.
Not that you aren't all fairly charming, and as for you..." He dropped a glittery wink at Alec, who looked astounded.
"Call me?"
Alec blushed and stuttered and probably would have stood there all night if Jace hadn't grasped his elbow and hauled him toward the door, Isabel at their heels. Clary was about to follow when she felt a light tap on her arm. It was Magnus.
"I have a message for you," he said. "From your mother."
Clary was so surprised she nearly dropped the pack.
"From my mother? You mean she asked you to tell me something?"
"Not exactly," Magnus said. His feline eyes, slit by their single vertical pupils like fissures in a green-gold wall, were serious for once. "But I knew her in a way that you didn't. She did what she did to keep you out of a world that she hated.
Her whole existence, the running, the hiding, the lies, as you called them, were to keep you safe. Don't waste her sacrifices by risking your life. She wouldn't want that. She wouldn't want me to save her? Not if it meant putting yourself in danger. But I'm the only person who cares what happens to her. No, Magnus said. You aren't. Clary blinked. I don't understand. Is there... Magnus, if you know something... He cut her off with brutal precision. And one last thing. His eyes flicked toward the door through which Jace, Alec, and Isabel had disappeared. Keep in mind that when your mother fled from the shadow world, it wasn't the monsters she was hiding from. Not the warlocks, the wolfmen, the fair folk, not even the demons themselves. It was them. It was the shadow hunters.
This ends Disc 6. City of Bones, Disc 7.
They were waiting for her outside the warehouse. Jace, hands in pockets, was leaning against the stairway railing and watching as the vampires stalked around their broken motorcycles, cursing and swearing. He had a faint smile on his face. Alec and Isabel stood a little way off. Isabel was wiping at her eyes, and Clary felt a wave of irrational anger. Isabel barely knew Simon. This wasn't her disaster. Clary was the one who had the right to be carrying on, not the shadow hunter girl. Jace unhitched himself from the railing as Clary emerged. He fell into step beside her, not speaking. He seemed lost in thought.